Nazism did not die in the ruins of Berlin in 1945, nor on the gallows at Nuremberg in 1946. It merely buried its uniform, slipped into mufti, and sauntered into the post-war world. Greetings from Prora.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 19th of May, 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol, but also from a corner of freedom close by the Pestana Palace Hotel in Lisbon, which is the venue for the 2023 Bilderberg Conference. We're on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. So, the Pestana Palace Hotel, over the last couple of days I've been spending quite a bit of time up there, opposite the police cordon around it, the outer security. Been interesting seeing the Chief of Police of Lisbon popping in and out, and various minions from the Bilderberg meetings as they turn up and they start getting agitated just before some very important guest comes in. And we've had several with the flashing blue light motorcycle cavalcades. Difficult to tell sometimes who it is, but Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, is in here. He also did a visit yesterday outside to see the Portuguese Prime Minister, and the Portuguese Prime Minister has now gone inside for dinner this evening, apparently. So that we've also got the Prime Minister of Denmark here, as well as the Prime Minister of Holland, plus many, many others. And we'll be talking to Guardian journalist and comedy writer, as well as just basic freelance decent journalist, Charlie Skelton, about this later. He's due in here at 6. To talk about some of the characteristics of this year's official list. Now, the Bilderberg conferences do issue an official list. It's a very secretive event. All of the people in there are sworn to secrecy, that is to say on Chatham House rules. But one thing we do know is that Yuval Noah Harari turned up yesterday at the airport. He was snapped by some of the vigilant photographers down at Lisbon Airport, who've been taking pictures all day yesterday and today of various dignitaries as they arrive. And we found that actually at the airport is the best place, it seems, to get photographs, because there is a pretty good system of blacked out tinted windows, very, very dark tinted windows. Well, what are they? They're little minibuses, really. Kind of lot vans converted into minibus or whatever. They are bringing in people who you literally cannot see anybody in there, unless maybe you had a flash or the light is just right and it's coming through the other window and you can see maybe through the tinted glass a little bit. But almost all of these people are coming in, the top people anyway, like that. We've had one or two very entertaining incidents where the security has stopped people. They've had to get out of their car. It's been a bit embarrassing. And we had David Lammy there, who's very friendly with the Bilderbergs. He had a bit of an embarrassing experience last year where he had to reveal all of his accounts that he had to do with Bilderberg, how much he got paid, etc. And the Public Accounts Committee or something similar in the British Houses of Parliament grilled him all about it. And it was rather embarrassing. But anyway, he's back this year, but he couldn't get in. His security, I remember this with Ed Balls many years ago, he couldn't get in, and so he was stood there like a lemon for a while until eventually, in fact, he was hidden behind a bush. And when they were saying, well, where is David Lammy, the journalist had to point out he's hiding behind that bush over there. So very embarrassing for him. But anyway, the point of this organisation is pretty clear. It's a way of the banks and the military in the West to choose and pick and get a good idea of who might be our next leaders. And as I said, Charlie's pointed out, there's lots of politicians here from the EU this week and, of course, from the UK. So I think, though, we're going to start with some other items before we get really stuck into Bilderberg. And we'll be doing some stuff about Agenda 2030 and about eugenics and about the Rockefeller family and their influence, because the Rockefellers have now gone. David Rockefeller died 4 or 5 years ago, who I met at the Bilderberg conference in 2003. Very nice chap, but he didn't want to talk about it at all. He knows when to keep his mouth shut. He knows which side his bread is buttered, and most of that bread is Rockefeller butter. Almost the bread is Rockefeller bread, isn't it? So they're very strict discipline. Yesterday, Mark Carney was strolling up the road, and I said, waved to him, said hi, Mark, and when he walked past, I called out his name again, and he just ignored me. So I said, shouted out even louder. I said, don't you know your own name? Mark Carney, of course, the former Bank of England governor, former Bank for International Settlements, in charge of their Committee on Regulations, which led, of course, to the 2008 financial crisis. So here's one of those people who likes to be an expert on everything, but actually part of causing the crises, and then, of course, waving their hands and saying, hey, guys, it's OK, we can sort everything out. Well, if you created the crisis, why should we trust you to sort anything out at all? And I'm thinking, of course, here about Ukraine, about artificial intelligence, about mainly, I suppose, about the cost of living crisis in economics, where we've got a bizarre situation now. With a solution being proffered, maybe Martin, you can comment on this, of upping interest rates in order to keep down inflation.
Well, they've got themselves into a no-win situation. They have to raise the only mechanism they have for dampening down inflation is raising interest rates. It's a standard thing that you're supposed to do.
Can't they bring interest rates below zero?
Well, they did do for a long period, and that's what set the bubble up, which is now about to burst. But of course, they've reached the point where they can no longer do that, because to keep interest rates at zero means that inflation will take hold. So they have to increase interest rates. But even a small increase in interest rates, when you've had zero interest rates or even negative interest rates for over a decade, runs the risk of crushing the entire economy. So that's what this is the problem they've got. If they want to bring inflation down, there are actually other mechanisms for bringing inflation down, and let's not go into them at the moment. Their only mechanism is by raising interest rates. But if they raise interest rates, they run the risk of crashing the global economy.
Well, it does sound as if it's almost an intentional thing. I mean, you know, yeah. I don't want to cast too many aspersions, but, you know, this seems to me to be something which is a fake solution to the problem, and a little bit like, you know, maybe having a vaccine might be a fake solution to the COVID crisis. But we also hope to be joined at six by Frederico Carvalho, who's done a lot of work here. He's a Portuguese journalist to uncover the Bilderberg meeting this year, back in end of January, beginning of February. There is also, I think, in part two, we're going to be taking a good look at this radiation plume over Poland, alleged radiation plume. Amazingly, the Germans took the actual radiation meter network of Europe, the EU's, which is run by the Germans, offline on Tuesday. So very difficult for anyone to really monitor what's going on anymore, which does sound to me as if maybe there's this is evidence that something is going on. And it could be the biggest one since Chernobyl, potentially more catastrophic because it's being covered up, if it is being covered up. The arms dump was blown up by Russian missile strikes last Sunday in western Ukraine, and the German-run public EU radiation scanners went offline. Still, the graphs up to that time show an enormous spike in gamma radiation. Now, I put the question, well, actually, uranium, depleted uranium in the shells may have been in this arms dump. They generally only emit alpha and beta, not gamma, but I was put straight by that by Dr. Chris Busby, and we'll be hearing from him later. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom, and us cancelled even off the tiddly little Bristol Community FM, but by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So I think maybe we should start, Martin, by having a listen to a report from Press TV, because I do find it absolutely disgusting the way that the British government and Ofcom are blocking these foreign channels. I mean, for example, countries like Russia now, Syria, imagine very soon China too, persona non grata, and we're not allowed to hear what they're saying, even if it's in the English language. This is extraordinary, particularly since the British didn't block the Nazi broadcasts in the Second World War. They realised that there would be a propaganda victory there for the Nazis.
Well, that's right. The information space is being, completely controlled in such a way that they can it doesn't fool people outside the West. They've got other mechanisms for finding what's going on. But I've been casually talking to people that I know, and many of them are unaware, for example, that there has been a pipeline blown up in the north, in the Baltic Sea, let alone the allegations that it was carried out by the Americans. And so you've actually got a kind of, a cleaned bubble space where people have very limited information. But of course, in the rest of the world, in South Africa, in Brazil, people know more about what's going on than we do. And, ultimately, that is going to tell, because if you make decisions based upon faulty information, you're likely to make the wrong decisions, aren't you?
Well, this is something that George Orwell made very clear when he resigned from the BBC. He said, actually, propaganda might be what people want, powerful people want, but actually, it has the opposite effect.
Well, it can do. I think the reason why
he's talking about the long term, Martin.
Yes, okay, but at the same time, in the short run, it's very effective. It does, in fact, lead to a situation where lots of people who don't really know what's going on think they do because they've been fed a line. And of course, you then get the sort of herd effect where people tend to agree with the other people around them. And if most people seem to think that such and such and so and so is the case, then most people don't bother to go looking any further. So it worked quite well on one level. It's pretty obvious to anybody who knows what's going on that the cost of living crisis in Europe has been caused by the Americans blowing up the pipeline. I mean, that's going to go on for decades.
Well, it's also, I think, listen, those prices of the fuel actually were going up before that happened, particularly when there was a so-called shortage of drivers here in late 2020. But look, we're going to have a listen now to Press TV. On Tuesday this week, they reported a demonstration in central London by hundreds, if not thousands, of Orthodox Jews. I mean, the photographs, it looks like about 1,000 to me, protesting about new laws. And I wondered, Martin, because of all this talk about anti-Semitism over the last few years, was there much reporting? Did you see much reporting in the UK about this demo?
I don't look at all the news, and I haven't heard anything about this. But
I did have a cursory look around. There didn't seem to be hardly any reporting on it at all. Isn't it bizarre that when Orthodox Jews turn out outside the Houses of Parliament protesting about anti-Semitism, that it isn't reported? And yet when there's some sort of rumour by a guy called John Mann MP that maybe there is some anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, well, why is it that that gets reported, whereas this gets hardly any mention, even though it's actually Orthodox Jews demonstrating in the streets of London?
Well, I don't know. You need to tell me more what it is they're demonstrating about and what the exact demands are. But we all know what's going on. It's the weaponization of the charge of anti-Semitism as a means of controlling public opinion. I mean, it's as blatant as that, isn't it? That's what it is.
Okay, so anyway, on Tuesday this week, there was a large demonstration in central London, in Westminster, of Orthodox Jews, by the Orthodox Jews, and it was reported by that banned channel Press TV, of course. You know, this is an Islamic channel, Islamic country, and yet there they are reporting on the grievances of the Jews in the UK. Absolutely amazing. So let's have a listen to that now.
Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This registered proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And that's, it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, Press TV, London.
So yes, that's Press TV about a demonstration on Tuesday this week. You know, I'm struggling to find any coverage whatsoever in the UK press about this, Martin. Maybe the London media is anti-Semitic.
Well, I mean, as we know, the decisions of like what things are put on TV and radio and newspapers is very arbitrary. So, you know, if people don't want, you know, for various reasons they don't want to cover this, then they won't, will they? They just won't.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, what it seems to me maybe going on here is the whole idea of anti-Semitism is it become weaponized, and therefore the monopolistic press, I mean, okay, so it's an oligopolistic press really in London, has got a kind of monopoly on the coverage of this issue. So obviously, it you know, it's something which presses a lot of people's buttons. And so what they're saying is, well, we're going to ignore 1,000 Orthodox Jews when they protest in London about anti-Semitism, and yet if we get, say, a Labour MP talking about it, using it to attack someone like Jeremy Corbyn, for example, we're going to put it all over the news for days, if not weeks.
Well, that's true. I mean, obviously, the misuse of the term anti-Semitism has become rife. But again, there's also just people, I mean, you know, people, minorities, and, you know, they are quite a small minority in Britain. They get ignored. You know, there's all sorts of other minorities that get ignored as well. I mean, they're complaining there about, LGBT teaching in schools. But, you know, in the past, there was no such, you know, that was a minority that was completely ignored and persecuted. Things have changed.
What was the minority?
Well, I mean, gay sex was illegal in Britain until 1967. So anybody who had gay sex got sent to prison. So that was, you know, that was in the past. But, you know, that's how it used to be.
Do you think of the parents' right to have an education along the lines like these Jewish schools that they're talking about here? Of course, we have similar things, don't we, with Muslim schools? And one of the reasons, I mean, we had protests in Bristol back in 2008, I think it was, as he says there, with the Muslim community saying, well, we don't want our kids to be taught that it's okay to have two parents of the same sex.
Well, this is an issue, quite clearly, but there's also going to be an issue if schools, for example, are funded by the government. if the government's paying for something, they're clearly going to want to have a say in what goes on when they're paying for it. If they're funding it themselves, there's another issue, which is, should children be completely under the control of their parents without anybody else having a say in what goes on? And of course, we've got loads of social workers who do, in fact, take kids away from their parents when it's felt that their best interests are not being represented. All of these things are very emotive and controversial, as we all know.
Yeah, they are. Well, I mean, the idea of the state social worker taking away a child, I mean, I've come across many cases where actually it would have been far better to leave the child with the parents. I mean, they seem to do interventions almost at the wrong time. But anyway, we're getting off the issue of the anti-Semitism, and I'd like to just play you a clip from 2006, which is a guy called Alan Hart, who's sadly not with us anymore. He was a fascinating figure. He worked both for the BBC and ITV as a foreign correspondent, and he knew several Israeli prime ministers, including Golda Meir personally, and so would actually have little soirees with these people when they were in London. But Alan wrote a book called Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. Before we hear from him, Martin, from this recording from 2006 at the Arnolfini in Bristol, at a talk with Tony Benn, which I organised with the National Union of Journalists branch, do you think you could say, give your definition of Zionism? Because this is such a key thing to understanding this whole anti-Semitism and Israeli issue.
Well, Zionism, spiritual Zionism, is a strand within religious Judaism, which believes in, a return to Zion, which could actually be a spiritual thing rather than a physical return. So let's just clear that one up. Zionism, modern Zionism, was invented by Theodor Herzl, who was a sort of intellectual author of the whole concept. And he believed that it was necessary to have a Jewish state in Palestine, because of the impossibility of Jews living safely in other communities.
And
this was in the 1900s, so it's long before the Nazis came to power.
The
beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. That's when Zionism appeared on the political stage. And of course, lots of nationalisms of various kinds appeared during this period. Ukrainian nationalism, for example, appears at just about the same sort of time. Irish nationalism, yeah? All of these nationalisms appear at the same sort of time because that's the sort of time it was where people started to think in terms of national identities and more extreme versions of national identities, and Zionism was one of those nationalisms. But of course, they didn't actually have a country to claim other than Palestine, which of course wasn't under their control. And at the time, of course, it was a very much a minority view, but certainly amongst Jews. Jews basically thought that they were cranks. That was certainly the view.
Was the original. But anyway, obviously was well-funded. They have many of these international Zionist congresses, and now we are where we are with the Israeli state, which has gone to the far right. In fact, seems to have taken on rather too many of the characteristics of Nazi Germany itself, with this, particularly with this far-right government, which sees itself as... I mean, this is you could make comparisons between the German idea of the German Untermensch and the Israeli state's idea that Jews, they say Jews, but really what we're talking about here is secular Jews, are somehow superior to everybody else in the region.
Well, I mean, all nationalisms can become extreme, can't they? Whether it's Zionist Israeli nationalism or German nationalism, Italian nationalism, English nationalism. I mean, it's all possible. US nationalism can be pretty gruesome. And this is, it's a problem. One of the things that can happen. And it doesn't mean that everybody can be tarred with the same brush, but we all know what these things can be like.
There is something positive about this nationalism, though, in Israel, in that there are a lot of people demonstrating on the streets about the move towards dictatorship of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And much of this was presaged in around about 2000, and I think it was 2005 that these Alan Hart's book, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews, a big two-part volume of somebody that really knew the area intimately and had watched as the Israeli state grew from the 1950s through the 60s and 70s, and as I say, knew some of the top people involved in all of that, and watched the Yom Kippur War and the various Arab-Israeli wars, the Six-Day War, etc., and watched this whole monster of the Israeli state develop. So let's have a listen now anyway to Alan Hart. The recording quality isn't 100%. We had a little bit of a problem with his mic, but anyway, we got the sound off of the speakers in the Arnold Feeney back in 2006. The author of Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews, Alan Hart now.
My case in essence is this. Since the obscenity of the Nazi Holocaust and Israel's unilateral declaration of existence in 1948 informed an honest debate about who must do what and why for peace in the Middle East has not been possible throughout the mainly Gentile Judeo-Christian world. Why not? Because its first and still existing draft of history is constructed on Zionist mythology, which is underpinned by the assumption that Zionism and Judaism, the religion of Jews, are one and the same thing. They are absolutely not. In terms of values and ethics, they are total opposites. And that's one of the reasons why it's perfectly possible to be passionately anti-Zionist without being in any way, shape or form anti-Semitic. Now, the first thing informed and honest debate needs is a definition of Zionism, because almost nobody understands what Zionism is. It is the nationalism of some Jews, actually a tiny minority of Jews at the time of the first Zionist mission statement in 1897, the nationalism which colonized land, Palestine, to create a state for Jews. An enterprise which required the incoming alien Zionist colonizers to ethnically cleanse the land of its Arab inhabitants. Now, it's still not politically correct to say so in today's world. Israel was created by Zionist terrorism and ethnic cleansing. Now, the core assertion of everything the media has taught us to believe, and I hope to make people believe it in my reporting days, the core assertion is this, that poor little Israel has lived in danger of annihilation, the driving into the sea of its Jews. The truth of history, the documented truth of history, is that Israel's existence has never, ever been in danger from any combination of Arab force. Zionism's assertion to the contrary was the cover which allowed Israel to get away where it mattered most in American Western Europe, with having its aggression perceived as self-defense. And the consequence of all this spin, all this propaganda, is the perception of Israel as the victim, when actually it is the aggressor.
So that's former BBC News, 9 o'clock News, and News at 10, ITV, foreign correspondent in the Middle East, Alan Hart, worked right the way through the 1960s and 1970s, and he ended up afterwards as an author. The book is Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. Anything to add to that, Martin?
Not really. I mean, it's fairly accurate. What I might suggest is that if you compare what the Zionists have done in Israel with what, for example, the Serbs tried to do in Yugoslavia, or the various other conflicts that are going on around the world of an ethnic nature, the Zionist Jews have been given a very, very easy ride. I mean, we went to war with Serbia to stop them dominating the Kosovans. Meanwhile, we arm and train the Israelis when they brutally aggress against their neighbours in Palestine. The double standards just stick out like a sore thumb, don't they?
They certainly do. And we're going to move on now to look at the, I think, interesting relationship between Jimmy Savile and our new coronated King Charles. Very important, I think, to understand that this was a very long-term relationship. It certainly was following a pattern with Charles. He was also a character referee for a certain Bishop Ball, B-A-L-L, in Gloucester, trying to say that this guy is fine and he should continue in his job, even whilst he was molesting children. We had the evidence from Bill Oddie last week that the reason that Savile was allowed to continue at the BBC molesting children and continuing in his role as the most prolific paedophile Britain has ever seen was directly because of his protection from Prince Charles. That's what Oddie had, you know, from the goodies had heard at the BBC, and he had evidence and reason to believe it. Anyway, I tracked down Chris Hewitt, who's a Coventry journalist, and he tells me here, I think it's an amazing little story, really, that Jimmy Savile, far from being somebody that was managed to keep away from the law, actually had been arrested at least six times before 1976. Amazing. Six times Savile had been arrested. So let's have a listen now to Chris Hewitt explain how much Savile had actually come close to the law. I mean, there must have been a massive track record, in fact, in amongst the police of evidence. And also, Chris would explain to you how he managed, after having been arrested, to then immediately get released again.
When I was a student, started off at the local tech in 1969. Obviously,
you
know,
we were in Coventry.
I was in Coventry Technical College. Yeah, in 1969, we looked at booking DJs for, you know, the May Ball and things like that, and somebody suggested Savile, and you know, contacts in the music business said, don't touch him. It said they want to know how old the girls were who started the tech, and I said they're 16, and this contact of mine said he likes them younger than that.
Right, so that's a rumour.
Yeah, and certainly when I went to uni, there were similar rumours going around then, and I met journalists over the years who tried to expose Savile, but again, nobody was interested. Eventually, I did manage to get Pete Waterman to firm it up, and that was in 1978.
Okay, so what did he say?
Oh, he confirmed that Savile was a paedophile.
Right, amazing. So at that point, you're starting to think, well, these rumours from college, now I'm a journalist, maybe we should get this out there.
Yeah, it should do, yeah. And, you know, when I approached some of the nationals, they just were not interested. And then I started doing a bit more digging, and I found out that Savile had been arrested on at least six occasions for offences against underage girls. Yep. On each and every occasion, he'd been released on the orders of Special Branch.
Oh, so do you know where he was arrested, when, roughly?
No, but he said this was prior to 1978. He'd been nicked at least six times.
So, and where did you get that information from?
Well, I have police contacts.
Yeah.
Because the West Midlands Vice Squad would like to have seen him locked up as well.
Oh, okay. So there were elements within the police that were trying to, you know, back in the 70s, trying to prosecute him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So he'd be, how did it work? He'd be lifted by the police, people with accusations, and then just let go.
Well, Special Branch specifically ordered him to be released.
Can you explain who Special Branch are for people that don't understand?
Well, the Special Branch was originally set up in Victorian times to keep an eye on the Republican side in Ireland, because they're actually known as the Special Irish Branch. But now they're interested in security issues.
Mm. Every force has its special branch officers, doesn't it? They seem to get very much involved in things like political policing. I was interviewed by special branch officers when I had death threats from the Jewish Defence League, for example.
Yeah. And so with the Vice Squad, because they knew he couldn't keep his hands to himself.
So, I mean, how does it work when somebody like the Vice Squad can't actually pursue prosecutions for pedophilia? I mean, that's their bread and butter, surely.
That's right, absolutely right. Well, Special Branch ordered Savile's release on at least six occasions. Now, they would only the only reason I can think that why that would happen is because he was an intelligence asset. See, MI5. Has been long been paranoid about the BBC. All these liberal programme makers were taking Moscow gold and all this sort of nonsense. By the way, police infiltration is nowhere near as common as conspiracy theorists say, because, frankly, they don't have the officers.
So how does it work with MI5? What's the implications of that? Because they're like military intelligence, aren't they?
Well, they don't gather a military. They actually deal with security of the state. But the MI5 have always had, well, I don't know about now, but certainly in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they had a certain paranoia about people who worked for the BBC, and the belief was that, you know, the KGB had heavily infiltrated.
So what are you suggesting, that he was a sort of a political informer for MI5 at the BBC?
Yes, almost, yes. That's the only thing I could think of.
Well, that's retired Coventry journalist Chris Ewer. Interesting conclusion he comes to there, Martin.
Yes, I think it's possible that Savile would have been chatting to Special Branch and MI5 about his colleagues at the BBC. But I think more importantly, he was at the centre of a paedophile network of blackmail. That's the key thing. The Kinkora Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland shows how this operates. And the intelligence service has been using prominent people that they want to target having sex with underage girls or boys as a means of blackmailing them. That is what I think is going on here.
This combined with the death of Diana, it doesn't necessarily bode well for Charles, does it? I think, you know, he's kind of expecting that everyone has forgotten about these two issues.
Well, the thing is that people like yourself, and to some extent myself and others, are interested in these topics, but quite a lot of other people just ain't. They ought to be, perhaps, but they're not. And he's not going to be, you know, there's no real danger to Charles from this kind of revelation at this stage.
Well, I mean, we do know the police get up to all sorts of nasty tricks, particularly when it comes to murdering private investigators. The one in question is Daniel Morgan, and evidence... I'm not sure if it's Alistair Morgan or Daniel Morgan. Do you know which one it is?
I can't remember, Tony.
Okay, well anyway, back in the 1980s, late 1980s, he was murdered. And I spoke to Alistair Morgan last week about this case because it's bubbled up into the news again. Yet again, the police are hiding. There's a whole load of evidence to do with this case that the police never allowed to go to the inquiry into this poor guy's murder. So really, I suppose it's the police covering up the murder, or at least conspiracy to murder, by the police, and the police being involved in the murder of someone who was investigating drug gangs and drug deals, in fact, involving the Met Police. So let's have a listen to Alistair Morgan now.
Alistair Morgan, brother of Daniel Morgan, the murdered private investigator in Southeast London, 1987. I don't think it's been done deliberately, but what it is incompetence, carelessness, and it's distressing in one way because a prosecution collapsed as a result of the, you know, the loss, mishandling, inability to locate paperwork. There was a prosecution which collapsed in 2011 after agonizing pre-trial hearings, which went on for 2 years at the Old Bailey, and the suspects all walked free, you know. So it has its, you know, it feels distressing, but what happened was this. I got a phone call 2 days ago in the morning from a journalist who told me basically the bare bones of this story without much detail, and that he'd said that he'd approached the Scotland Yard about this, but they had refused to confirm or deny his story. Then, within 12 hours, we got a letter. My solicitor rang me in the evening and told me that he'd had a letter from the Assistant Commissioner Barbara Gray at Scotland Yard, giving him this the admission. This was true. They weren't admitting anything about the journalist, but they were saying that this was the case. We have found this covered with a number of documents in it. And even now, after this, my feeling is that would we ever have been told about this if the journalist hadn't been poking around in this case, you know?
Yeah, this has dragged on a long time, Alistair. What do you know about why your brother was killed and who by?
Well, I have to be very, very careful legally about what I say here. But there were allegations of police involvement in the murder, one set of allegations which was suppressed for over 30 years by the police, Complaints Authority, as then was, and Hampshire Police. You know, it was, we only found out about this, these allegations 2 years ago. They'd been suppressed for over 30 years. And for the Met, Hampshire Police, and the police watchdog to be involved in suppressing allegations of police involvement in my brother's murder for over 30 years. Now, I think that speaks pretty loudly, you know, that, you know, the informant system has been abused in historically on many, many occasions. I understand that, but I'm not quite sure whether this comes into that category. I don't think there was any kind. The abuse, I think, was from the police trying to suppress this, these allegations, you know.
Is there anything the public can do to help, really, to put pressure on the police? Because, you know, there is this major problem, is that the police do not seem to like investigating themselves and certainly not finding themselves guilty.
Yeah, well, independent investigation of the police, I think, is probably going to have to take place. You know, I mean, the current police watchdog is stuffed with ex-police officers and ex-state, ex-government investigators, and the whole thing has become rather incestuous, you know, or very incestuous, and doesn't perform the purpose that it is required.
Is any way for people to follow the case, Alistair?
Well, I'm on Twitter. My name is Alistair with an A-L-A, Alastair Morgan, and I'm on Twitter under that name.
Okay, Alistair Morgan, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, it's interesting, Martin, isn't it, how these stories emerge, where the journalist is actually doing a little bit of inquiring themselves, and they find there's a cabinet with a whole load of documents in it about the death of Brian Morgan back in the late 1980s. Daniel Morgan, yeah, back in the late 1980s, who, and without the journalist inquiring, this story last week would never have hit the headlines at all. And in fact, it was reported in almost all papers that this evidence had just been left in a locker and forgotten about. I mean, of course, you don't know. The police know this, that if they're told they must disclose everything they have on a particular subject, and then they either stick stuff in the shredder, flush it down the toilet, or just leave it in a locked off case, no one is any the wiser.
Well, as we know, the Metropolitan Police is under pretty serious pressure at the moment to reform its working practices, because over many years these kind of cases have been regular features of their way of operating.
Well, that's right, but I mean, he said a couple of things there that really are, you know, make you wonder if there's any point at all in even pursuing these things. Absolutely, are the police the biggest criminals in London? He's saying that there was new evidence was surfaced in 2021, as well as this we've heard last week, and yet there was a 2011 prosecution of officers where none of this evidence, even the 2021 evidence that surfaced and the one from 2023, none of that was available to the prosecutors. And so it's no wonder that these police involved got off.
Well, if you are a crooked police officer, you're going to take all the steps necessary to make sure you don't get caught, aren't you? And being that you've received police training, you're probably going to be quite good at that, aren't you? So that's the problem you've got.
Yeah, what he says, he makes it absolutely clear there, we must have independent scrutiny and investigation of the police. Otherwise, this stuff is just going to carry on. Okay, on to another topic now, and that's pesticides. We had a report a few weeks ago. I've been going through this old Mark Purdy interview bit by bit, and we're coming up to the section where he talks about his personal battle. I mean, it's an incredible interview of the physical intimidation deaths around his case of Mark Purdy. Now, he was an organic farmer down in Devon who took the Ministry of Agriculture to court and won saying that the reason that BSE and CJD are so rife in Britain is because of all these organophosphate chemicals which you're pouring into our animals, actually going right through the animal's skin into the body and causing not only the animals to freak out with mad cow disease, but also anyone that eats that meat, then they start getting CJD, God knows what else, because these things are incredibly poisonous and destroy the nervous system. So anyway, you did an amazing job, Mark. But I thought we'd just go back now to have a little look at this. We had a story about the badger cull last week, about his investigation into the... It's a little part of the previous one we heard about the effect of pesticides on the badgers, and why that he thinks the pesticides are responsible for the bad immune system of the animals, probably both the badgers and the cows and other livestock, not TB.
The chemicals are not only used, you know, they're used in farming. They're put into the source of the food chain. From there, they're getting into the water supplies. They're in the rain. I mean, they're appearing in as far away areas such as Iceland, affecting the polar bears. They get into the fat of animals throughout the entire food chain, build up the food chain, which was well evidenced by the effects of DDT in the middle of last century. In the modern world, I mean, I think it's become very apparent that, you know, I run an organic farm where I'm not putting in a whole sort of array of chemicals into my cattle. And literally, our vet bill 2 years ago was only £60, which I think a lot of farmers just wouldn't believe it, you know. We have TB in some of the herds around us. Those cattle are, you know, having those badgers, the cattle are having contact with my cows, but my cows aren't getting TB. They always pass the test because I believe their immune systems are intact. They have a healthy immune system. Because a lot of the chemicals that are used in modern agriculture, they attack directly at the T cells, which is the fundamental mainstay of the immune system. And if you take those away, then a whole range of viruses, bacteria that are endemic in our environment will suddenly get a hold. That's why once you've damaged the immune system, then you can get a whole load of viruses. But I think the establishment is very quick to blame the virus because as the primary cause, you know, the virus is the primary cause because nobody's responsible for a virus. It's not yet mass manufactured, so no one can be held accountable. So it's a very convenient scapegoat to blame a virus. A lot of ME sufferers find that they have a whole host of bacteria and viruses that have taken a hold in their systems, and that they've never found one single virus to cause the blame on. And this is classic of a case where there's been an immune wipeout, so that any virus that is endemic in their particular environment just gets in there. And this is, in a sense, it shows the futility of some of, for instance, the vaccination programs that our children are being subjected to. Because those children, what we need to concentrate on is maintaining a healthy immune system so they can survive the daily challenge of E. coli or Coxsackie or whatever's in their particular environment. The answer to good health is nurturing a healthy immune system. And it's not sort of vaccinating people against things that are all around us. I mean, meningitis is living in most of our throats all the time. And someone gets meningitis when they're exposed to something that destroys the immune response in the saliva, the antibodies in the saliva. One of the key areas that organophosphates hit is a neurotransmitter, a sort of hormone in the brain called serotonin. And organophosphates actually sort of, at low levels, burn off the endings of this serotonin. And serotonin sort of presides over the whole immune system, the immune response system. It presides over the amount of lymphocytes that are released into the circulation, both the T lymphocytes and the B lymphocytes. And it is through a disruption of the lymphocyte system that you get what's called sensitization, and this is the seeding of allergies that are occurring very frequently now in humanity.
That's the wonderful voice of a certain Mark Purdy, who I met first, I think, in around about 1999 at one of the Green Party conferences. One of those people who, a really exceptional man, who had done all the research himself. He was quite well grounded in physics and other science and chemistry, and he'd learned all the extra stuff he knew in order to understand how these organophosphate pesticides operate. Also looked into their Nazi origins and all that sort of thing as well. And we're going to hear now from someone who's doing that sort of campaigning that Mark was doing back in the noughties. I mean, he died in suspicious circumstances 5 years after we interviewed him. And in the next episode, in a couple of weeks' time, I'll be playing, you'll hear all about how, for example, his lawyer died in mysterious circumstances, how when he had an article in the Independent newspaper, overnight his telephone wires were cut so that all the follow-up press was lost the next day. This is the chemical industry, folks. ICI, in this case, most probably, making sure that the information about what was getting out about the liabilities that they had for causing BSE, CJD, mad cow disease, and basically poisoning the entire food chain was kept out of the public eye. And so we're going to hear now from an up-to-date campaigner on this whole topic. Her name is the lovely Georgina Downs. I probably shouldn't say that if I'm being politically correct, but she is wonderful. She started a campaign which is all to do with spray drift. So people that live next to arable fields are getting this stuff just blowing in through their windows in the summer, these same sort of chemicals, these pesticides, into their house, choking them. And I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago about what's going on in the UK pesticides campaign that she runs, because she's just taken a successful case to the High Court to say, well, why is it that, for example, the agricultural workers that are spraying this stuff have got a very high level of protection, and yet the people whose houses it blows then straight into have none at all?
My name's Georgina Downs. I'm the founder and director of the UK Pesticides Campaign, which is basically an independent campaign that fights for people who live next to pesticide-sprayed crop fields. Which there's just no protection whatsoever for that category of persons. And of course, when I found this out 20 odd years ago, that there simply was no protection. There's protection for operators with protective equipment. They've got to wear, respirators, goggles, personal protective equipment. There's literally nothing for a resident who could be inches away breathing in the very same, toxic air that an operator is required to have protection from. And once I found that out, and that complete, very perverse dichotomy, if that's the right word, between the two, then it needed somebody to take this on, which is what I started to do back in 2001.
Well, I lived in Biggin Hill years ago, and we had crops sprayed out the back of our house. Well, we used to actually get in the car when that was happening and leave, because it stank. But surely, I mean, this stuff is toxic to insects. It's not toxic to us.
Well, no, yeah, oh, absolutely toxic to human health. I mean, a lot of pesticides are neurotoxic, carcinogenic, toxic to the reproductive system, respiratory system. It can damage eyes. You've got a whole long list of different adverse effects that are on the safety data sheets that are provided by the manufacturing company of these pesticides. So you only have to look at these data sheets, and they say toxic to eyes, toxic to respiratory. Some say toxic by inhalation. Some say maybe fatal if inhaled. Now, that's quite clear. But, if you inhale this stuff, it's going to not have a good outcome. So these are really toxic and dangerous, both in the short and the long term, because you can have acute effects, which are things like, burning eyes, sore throat, swollen throat, breathing problems, headaches, vomiting, or you can have long-term effects, like different cancers have been connected and associated with pesticides, and you've got a whole raft of different neurological conditions that have been connected to pesticides, like Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis.
How would you know if something that you've got is caused by pesticides? Is it possible to tell?
Well, we had, in our case, we had blood and fat samples taken to check for pesticides in our system. So we had categoric proof and evidence that pesticides were found in our system. And the doctor that interpreted the results said that we had the most pesticides that she'd ever seen in our system. But both myself and my mother, and my mother has got advanced Alzheimer's, which was diagnosed a few years ago, and was connected by her neurologist as being, you know, probably most likely to do with the fact that she's lived next to sprayed fields for so many decades and been exposed to all of that. So, but when you have, like we had, found all sorts of different neurotoxics, we had organophosphates, we had carbamates, pyrethroids, organochlorines, a whole raft of different pesticides found in our blood and body fat. So when you have that, and when you go on to develop a condition that is known to be associated with pesticide exposure, then I don't think it really takes a, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to sort of connect the two.
What's happening with your High Court case now?
Well, basically in 2008, I won a landmark High Court victory against the government over its fundamental failure to protect rural residents and communities from pesticide exposure and from crop spraying with mixtures and cocktails of different chemicals that are used on fields, because it's not just one chemical that's used every now and again, it's a whole array of different mixtures that are used throughout every year. And so I took the government on for the failure to protect residents. It was accepted by the High Court, who said that there was, you know, an absolute failure. Unfortunately then, with the lots of shenanigans that went on, there was the higher court, the Court of Appeal, unfortunately ignored all the evidence that won in the High Court, substituted it with something else, and it got overturned. I then went to the European Court of Human Rights, hoping that that would be interested in, you know, taking it forward. But at that particular time, they hadn't had a case of this sort, and so they you know, there was they weren't, you know, didn't seem to be particularly interested in taking this forward on a human right basis. I think it has to be remembered that the European Court of Human Rights is just on the human right point. But actually, anybody with half a brain, I think, can see that it's got to be a breach of human rights. And that was upheld in the High Court, that it was a breach of Article 8, you know, right to you know, to be able to enjoy your peaceful enjoyment of your property and your land.
So that's Georgina Downes there, an absolutely amazing campaign that she runs. It's called the UK Pesticide Campaign. There are various of these pesticide campaigns. She there's a longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with her, and maybe pop that up on YouTube or something as well, because the work she's doing is so important. It's really not being discussed at all, and it looks to me, Martin, as if the pesticide companies basically now control the regulation of these chemicals.
Well, it wouldn't be at all surprising, would it? I mean, we are a corporate oligarchy, and that's how corporate oligarchies operate, isn't it?
What are your thoughts about the I mean, I know you're not a medical person, neither am I, but there's all sorts of conditions which could be caused by these pesticides. They're very persistent.
Well, I mean, it seems pretty
in body fat, for example, they hang around for years, you know.
Well, it seems pretty obvious that something that kills living things, which is what pesticides are, is potentially going to be dangerous to other living things, especially as it can be accumulated through the food chain. So,
well, I mean,
yeah.
I'm interested because this is the tadpole season, as you probably know. And I was collecting tadpoles, you know, like you do the other day. And I put them in a little bowl, and these I think were newt tadpoles. And so I put them in a bowl. They were fine for a day. And then I had a look online stupidly. Oh, yeah, they can eat broccoli, but you have to try and make sure it's only organic, right? So I got some broccoli, and I thought, well, it's not organic, but they'll probably enjoy this. And I let it boil. Steamed the broccoli for about half an hour or something, maybe 25 minutes, and a tiny little bit of broccoli I popped into the tadpole's bowl. Obviously, it's not organic, so I'm basically committing a terrible offence there. But anyway, the next morning, all but one of those tadpoles was dead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it may well be, as you say, that the pesticide on the broccoli was the cause, but, you know,
well,
you can't...
The thing is, tadpoles are known to be incredibly sensitive to these chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I'm having another shot with a new set of tadpoles, and we'll see how they're getting on when we get back from Lisbon. But so anyway, talking about Lisbon, We're joined now by Charlie Skelton. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. How are you?
Well, we're very well. I know you've been having a look. You did the first kind of take yesterday, or not? Was it yesterday? Yes, it was Thursday. On the list as it's published. Now, for many years, we never had a list. So, for example, when I was doing the Bilderberg coverage, as it, whatever we could do in 2000 and 2003, it was quite difficult to get hold of. And sometimes you could get a list from, say, a journalist that had been sent a press release of the list of people inside that said at the top in big letters, not for publication. Now things have changed a bit, haven't they?
Well, there was also the idea that the list would be slipped under Jim Tucker's door. Also. But yes, it's they do publish a list these days, but they always publish it at the very last minute. So it was 9 o'clock on Thursday morning. So it's quite inconvenient for journalists to have it that late, and obviously they know that. But yeah, we do have the list, and it makes for giddying reading.
Well, it does, and you've pointed out. I would absolutely agree with you. That it seems to be quite top heavy with politicians from the EU countries this year, the NATO countries mainly.
A lot, yeah. Three prime ministers, and quite a few senior ministers, and also the president of the EU Parliament, two European commissioners, the vice president of the European Commission. I mean, there's a lot of policymakers here at the Pistana Palace. I think noticeably a lot of politicians. But, and, you know, and the more politicians there are, the trickier the extreme privacy is to justify.
Well, I would suggest it's actually impossible to justify. So we've got, from the UK, we've got Tom Tugendhat, who's the security minister. He's under Ben Wallace, the defence secretary. We've also got, he's a minister, whereas Ben Wallace is the defence secretary. Somebody called Dan Bisamoyo, who I'd never heard of, but they're apparently a member of the House of Lords. Is there any light you can throw on these? We've got David Lammy as well. Right at the very start, I was saying David Lammy had a bit of trouble getting in today.
Baroness Moyo is also on the board of Chevron. So she is also representing big oil, and there's quite a big contingent.
Isn't that fun?
As ever from there.
Because we've got Total, BP and Shell in there. Now, I reckon we're talking around about 100 billion, maybe 120 billion annual profit from those four people.
But also the CEO of Galp, the big Portuguese interest. But they never really put on the list their main job. So Sir John Sawyer is the former head of MI6, who's on the board of Bilderberg, on their steering committee. He's listed as something like the executive chairman of Newbridge Advisory, which isn't anything at all, that's just his private company. What he is, he's a director of BP. But they don't trumpet that fact. And so BP is there with him, and also I think the CEO is there.
So is his private company based in the Cayman Islands?
I think it might be like Surrey or something. But it's the company that paid David Lammy's travel last year to Washington, and probably again this year.
Okay, so can you do a little bit of drilling down, a bit of analysis? What is these names? There is a bit of hidden stuff. You've dug out some of that, but what's it telling us about what's going on in there?
Well, I mean, it tells us that the large number of CEOs that are here, you know, people like the head of Pfizer, the head of BASF, the head of AXA, the head of Prudential, not just, you know, these are the heads of these companies. They've all taken time out of their busy schedules to be here. But, I mean, there are people with even busier schedules than that, like the Supreme Allied Commander Europe and the Secretary General of NATO. I think what it says above all is that these people, the business folk and the, the military and intelligence complex, take Bilderberg extremely seriously. I mean, it's like the biggest event in a lot of their calendars. And yet, you know, there's just you and me and a Portuguese magazine photographer outside the gates, and, yeah, you know, and a few people at the airport, a few people the other side. You know, it's a paltry turnout as ever from the press.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? More journalists inside saying nothing about it than outside trying desperately to get the message out, the word out. Now, you've had a couple of encounters with Bilderbergers, haven't you, as part of this? I mean, I haven't really managed to kind of tangle up with both, but you have. So tell us about that.
Well, I had all my luck, really, at the very beginning, where I saw a Mercedes parked outside a pharmacy and put two and two together and thought, I think someone may have stopped on the way in to get something, and I was right. And out from the pharmacy comes Victor Halberstadt, who is the sort of European boss of Bilderberg, very senior. And
He's based in Leiden, the Netherlands, isn't he?
That's right. And he comes out with his barrier cream that he'd bought, and he comes across the road, and I address him and say, "Oh, Mr. Halberstadt." And he just looks at me and goes, "No." And I'm really confused. So I say, "Sorry, Mr. Halberstadt?" And he just goes, "No." And gets into the car, which I found really perplexing, because it's such an odd thing. He might as well go, "Yes, hello," or something. But for some reason, he thinks that saying, even denying that he is Mr. Halberstadt, is some sort of a cloak under which he can hide his dealings.
It does sound like his knee-jerk reaction to anything unexpected is to lie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is worrying for such a sort of powerful organisation. So, are you sure it was him? I mean, you know, come on, I don't want to sow seeds of doubt.
It's definitely him.
Yeah, well, you showed me
also,
a photograph.
Yeah, and he whizzed off in this BMW through the security cordon of the hotel. So, if it wasn't him, then they decided to put a Victor Halberstadt lookalike and invite him to the conference.
A clone.
A clone, maybe.
Okay, so anyone else?
Oh, and then, yes, well, later on I met the lovely Mrs. Kravis, who is, she's the head of the Museum of Modern Art in the US, but she's also...
Responsible for the state of modern art in the US.
She is. And she is also on the board of Bilderberg. She's sort of the American equivalent of Halberstadt, but more glamorous. She's also on the board of LMVH and many other things. So anyway, Jose-Marie Kravis...
It's worth chipping in a bit about the CIA's involvement in the control of art in the Western world, because they have this thing called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and they put a lot of money in during particularly the 1950s, 60s and 70s that we know about. The best book on it I've seen is Francis Donald Saunders' The Cultural Cold War, where actually the CIA are very, very interested in art, and they want to steer it in their direction.
I mean, partly, I guess, because it's sort of part of, you know, make everything new and kind of wipe the slate clean.
Well, it can be very political art, can't it?
Absolutely.
Or else it can be bland. I mean, for example, with the Society of the Spectacle and, you know, the Situationists in France actually made a really big thing of revolutionary art. You know, here, we're overturning the establishment, and this is an artistic movement. The Americans, there's very little chance for that.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because just because the CIA promoted Jackson Pollock doesn't make Jackson Pollock a kind of force for terror and awfulness. But, you know, these are the weird facts you have to kind of unpick.
He certainly didn't seem very radical with his splashing paint around. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. Is it the other Kravis person you were just starting to talk about?
Oh, sorry, José-Marie. Her husband is Henry Kravis, who runs KKR, who's kind of the Gordon Gekko figure of Bilderberg. And
can you just explain that?
He looks like a gecko. No, he does. But he's I think he is literally the person that Gordon Gekko is based on, as in Michael Douglas in Wall Street. So he's an extremely rapacious financier. And worth reading the beginning of I think it's Enemy at the Gates, which is about the Nabisco buyout, and he features heavily in that. He's quite something. They went off shopping, came back in the cab, just pulled up next to me on the way when they came back to the...
Just outside the cordon.
Just outside the cordon. So I leant in and said to... I obviously addressed her because she's much more powerful than he is, even though he's got the money. And said, "Mrs. Kravis, are you looking forward to the conference?" She went, "No." Which is, again, I think it might be a sort of generalised no that they give. That it may not have any real content, but I kind of like the idea that she's not looking forward to it.
Yeah, you do wonder, don't you, whether some of these people feel like they've been sort of almost trapped in a Bilderberg web and they've got to be here, but they actually don't really. I can remember chatting with the Greek finance minister years ago. He came out for just get out of the conference. He said, I hate the atmosphere in there. Yeah. I've come out for some cigarettes. I'm really sorry. But they took the participant list off me as I was leaving because I had it in my hand. I should have had it in my inside pocket and I would have given it to you. So there are people in there who definitely don't like the whole atmosphere and what it's all about.
It happened in I think it was Copenhagen, where the head of a giant Norwegian power company went jogging at one point and then came back and kind of just sort of huffed and puffed and shuffled around the gate and didn't want to go in. And a couple of people, I think it was Lou Gradowski and my wife Hannah, said hello and are you all right? And he just because he just didn't seem like he was enjoying it. And he said no. He says very intense. He didn't want to go back in. He just says very, very intense. And it isn't, you know, the whole thing, the conference is run as a kind of, you know, schooling for everyone. Everyone sits in, you know, rows and raises their hand. And it's very, there's a lot of information, you're expected to participate all the time.
Well, maybe the police were shouting at me yesterday for my own protection.
I think so.
To keep away.
Yeah, keep away.
The ultimate aim, what do you think is going on here? I mean, this is something that you've been covering for... Actually, you've been to many more than I have, Charlie. So what's the trajectory of this group?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd say it's not one thing. And I think that applies to almost anything that gets discussed in any of these areas. It's never really one thing. So, you know, Bilderberg is lots of different things. So it's obviously it's a kind of recruitment drive for the elite. It's a massive lobbying opportunity for some of the biggest lobbyists in the world, which is a theme I keep harping on about because I think it's quite an easy one for people to get. It is a kind of, you know, policy summit as well, but it's also a NATO summit, you know. I mean, the Secretary General of NATO generally comes.
Yeah. And there's a little love-in session, obviously, with the Foreign Minister of Ukraine in there going on. I'm just going to run through this is what they say they're talking about. Ukraine is not quite at the bottom as it was last
year. It's alphabetical, Tony.
It is. So we'll start with AI. Now, that's all over the news today, yesterday, this week. Banking system. So I guess this is where they're thinking about creating the biggest crisis the world has ever seen in order to force central bank digital currencies down people's throats.
Absolutely.
China, energy transition. So if there's a war in the Middle East, we need to be ready for no oil coming over. Europe, fiscal challenges, which is probably the banking system coming along too. India, that's an interesting thing to see popping up on the agenda.
Very
there.
Odd.
Industrial policy and trade, NATO, obviously, this is kind of NATO's conference, Russia, transitional threats.
Transnational threats?
Oh, sorry, transnational threats, yeah.
So I guess things like diseases.
Well, maybe, yeah, that's the sort of thing. Well, actually, a threat, you see, to the Bilderberg is a great opportunity, as we saw during COVID.
Absolutely.
Ukraine and finally US leadership. And it's worth saying we've got a protest going on here lunchtime tomorrow. Actually, I'm not sure how much it's going to be actually up at the hotel itself. Apparently, it's going to be a little bit away from the hotel, organised by a Portuguese judge or retired Portuguese judge who's been very critical of the whole COVID business, the lockdowns and all that sort of thing. But as part of that, there's apparently going to be a screening of a video of support for the protest at Bilderberg from Robert Kennedy, who's now announced he's standing to be the Democrat nominee for US president. So I wonder if they'll be chit-chatting about Robert Kennedy at their US leadership seminar.
Well, I scoured the list and he's not on it. So he's...
No, I think not.
It's a... I'm surprised they put that on there as a topic, US leadership, because it kind of makes them seem a bit grubbier in a way. You know, they're sort of they're trying to get involved with, you know, party politics. You'd expect them to kind of float a little bit more transnationally above such interests. But, they are discussing that. There's quite a few big pharma types to be discussing the transnational threats.
What do you think is going to happen? We've got talking about Tucker Carlson possibly standing for the Republican nomination. Certainly Trump seems to be being pushed back by various court cases, making it difficult. The Florida governor, DeSantis, may be standing. But this is, of course, something, you know, human needs to replace the Biden. Otherwise, the world is going to hell in a handcart.
Well, it may just be that GPT-5 replaces Biden, which will probably be a bit more human. Which, by the way, the guy who Sam Altman, who runs OpenAI, is one of the big AI people who are here. And a lot of these, like Eric Schmidt and Sam Altman, have just been testifying this week to various hearings about artificial intelligence. So it's very interesting that they've made their statements, then come over here. And they have slightly different views on the regulation of AI. Sam Altman seems to be more in favour of governments trying to regulate AI, and Eric Schmidt is a kind of nod to Kissinger as a kind of a more of a pessimistic, or, you know, in inverted commas, realist, saying that companies should just get on with it and regulate it themselves.
Well, this is what they do, isn't it? This is what these guys do. They create a new technology, whether it's a war or whatever, or an economic disaster, and then they say, it's okay, guys, we can sort it out for you.
Absolutely. But the weird thing about AI is that they both say, yes, don't worry, we'll sort it out, and at the same time say, we have no idea, we can't sort it out. So you get that from... So Kissinger and Schmidt wrote a book together on AI, and it's... You know, it's pretty pessimistic in a way, their take on things. Kissinger's sort of waving goodbye to the Enlightenment as human reason gets sort of kicked to the curb and AI's, you know, black box thinking takes over. So it's, you know, it's, as he, you know, and he's here, I guess, waving goodbye to Bilderberg as well, because I can't see he's going to be here again.
Why not? I mean, I know he's turning, next week he turns 100, but he does seem to like coming back. And he may have been a bit disappointed because he seems to have been grooming Eric Schmidt to take over from him
on
the steering committee. And yet Eric Schmidt apparently left today. I mean, Kissinger, I would imagine, is feeling a little bit like Boris Yeltsin when Putin took over. The guy I've groomed to take over now is not interested in my pet project.
Or Eric Schmidt's left in a huff because Kissinger has, you know, reached past him to pat someone else on the shoulder, like Alex Karp or something.
Actually, apparently he's gone over to speak at the G7 in Tokyo, so that's why Schmidt left, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, this is...
Because he's packing in his summits.
He is, isn't he? Yeah. Something more important? Well, actually, how does the G7 compare? Because, of course, it was the G8 when Russia were involved, how does it compare to Bilderberg and the World Economic Forum as well? These various, you know, places where the rich and powerful get together to control our destiny. How does Bilderberg fit into those?
Well, one thing you'd have to say is that the statements that come out of something like the G7 are all so facile and pre-prepared and thin. So just to go back to AI, you would... Just these sort of nothingy remarks come out from Rishi Sunak or Ursula von der Leyen about, you know, yes, don't worry, we're just going to invest in AI, but don't worry, there'll be guardrails. And that's about it. You know, it's just, it's thin gruel. And I guess that the gruel at Bilderberg is thicker, but we don't get to taste it. But also from the perspective of a journalist, it's an incredibly different experience. Because I went to a G20 one year as a journalist, and it's just like going to a luxury party. You're just given free food, free drink, champagne on tap, and then here's all the footage and information you could possibly want. And then it was followed just across the border, I think, into Austria, was Bilderberg, and I went, just drove over the border and was immediately surrounded by like 20 police and told to get out of the car, you know, show me your papers. Yeah. Having just spent, you know, 3 days as a, having my feet massaged by the establishment. And then, you know, so, you know, that's the big difference as someone trying to cover these events, is that they just, Bilderberg doesn't want you to cover it.
Mm. I noticed actually Portugal, it's been lovely here in Lisbon, and you get a sense that Bilderberg doesn't quite fit here with the former Prime Minister having trouble getting in. I think it was Stoltenberg yesterday having to leave the conference to go and speak separately to the current Prime Minister. What do you make of it? Because, I mean, you spend quite a bit of time in Portugal. What do you make of the relationship between the Portuguese? And, I mean, I look around, I see a place which hasn't been Bilderbergized or McDonaldized so much as the UK. You know, for example, public toilets still open. You know, you've got music, you've got musicians playing in the evenings in the open air. It's a much more alive city, it seems to me, and more, with more care and attention to the public spaces than anywhere I know in the UK.
Well, you know, it's small C conservative in the way it runs, which has lots of implications. It's, you know, it's not super efficient, but it's more human.
Catholic sounds a bit.
No, well, really, you know, yeah, it's a bit Catholic. Yeah. So you get, you know, the family unit is a bit stronger. Yeah. I mean, so lots. You go to any of the. I live out in the middle of nowhere, and you go to any of the little festivals, and everyone's there all the time. You know, the children are there at 3 a.m. You know, listening to the squeeze box or falling asleep in grandma's lap, etc. So it's a much more integrated society still. It hasn't disintegrated in the way that some have, and it's you know, there's. There's pluses and minuses to that, because it is quite, as I say, quite conservative. So I think they find expats, they're very warm and welcoming to them, but they also find them a bit baffling and weird.
Yeah, even the Lidl's we've been going to around the corner, it's actually quite, you know, really nice food. The staff have seemed pleasant. There's not so much security.
Oh, look, everything's a little bit nice. Portuguese Lidl's is amazing. Yeah, it is amazing.
Yeah, well, this is Germans moving in. Anyway, look, I think we ought to play a clip now, because really I think one of the main, I mean, particularly in the news this week, has been AI, and where is it going? Who's going to control it? Is anyone going to, how worried do we really need to be? And with Eric Schmidt sort of in charge, it seems now, of the Bilderbergers, I got a sense that there's something really creepy about Google, actually, in that people kind of interact via Google now, rather than, now say, for example, if you want to find out, you know, where you're going in a strange city like we are, we're now in a situation where our first option is to ask Google. Well, you know, maybe we should just be having a chat to the locals, trying to talk, you know, a bit of communication, show them the map, let them point at our little map. But we don't have a map. What we've got now is a phone. Google seems to have taken over that kind of interaction that people normally had.
Well, everything is mediated, isn't it? So everything gets mediated by technology. And as a, you know, as a writer, I find that concerning, because a lot of my conversations with fellow writers are on Zoom, and, you know, or in some other way mediated. And the sort of unmediated experience that you're talking about, and the sort of analog experience of grabbing a map and pointing and walking, you know, that's becoming less and less of a thing. You know, it's in the way that, you know, getting lost in a city is almost a political act. You know, you can't. It's getting harder and harder to get lost, because the system that you carry around with you knows where you are all the time. And yeah, that's creepy.
So yeah, I mean, it seems also we're living these few years at the moment where. The internet, everyone's kind of got on the internet, and now the internet is kind of getting nasty, and it's starting to lie, it's starting to, and also, of course, surveillance is becoming everywhere. You're talking about having chats with writers on Zoom. I mean, this isn't necessarily a private conversation you're having, is it?
It's definitely not a private conversation. And, you know, as I work in inverted commas work, in writers' rooms for comedy, and it's a very odd experience, because the writer's room used to be a kind of, slightly sacrosanct area where you could say anything, and, you know, off the record, in order to get stuff on back onto the record that was funny, and you had to occasionally swerve into awfulness.
A Ukrainian comedian arrested for making a joke about the police.
Good. No, it's terrible. Sorry. The inability for comedy to function at the moment, that's a whole other.
It was China, I think. It was just a couple of days ago. This kind of thing is starting to... Comedy is being... I suppose this is the CIA's wish to control the arts. They would very much like to control comedy, and maybe that's why it's in such a terrible state. I don't think... The best BBC comedy we've seen for the last couple of years was the interview with Elon Musk, where Elon Musk was just tearing this poor interviewer to shreds.
I'm sorry, the best comedy we've seen has been the Prince Andrew interview. That was a stunning comedy special.
So anyway, we're going to have a listen now to Dr. Chris Busby, who I've interviewed. We're going to be hearing another part of the interview a little bit later about this plume of gamma radiation, which has been spreading across, we're told, across Poland from Ukraine after an arms dump exploded last Sunday, attacked by the Russians. But he had also quite a lot to say about what he thinks Bilderberg is about, and things like the influence of artificial intelligence.
We're over in Lisbon at the Bilderberg meeting this week. I wonder what you make of that. They're talking a lot about technology, how technology is going to save us somehow. I mean, we've got one of the main themes here. Obviously, they're talking about Ukraine. They usually put it at the bottom of their official agenda, although, of course, it's very important to NATO because this really is a sort of NATO political lobby here. But they're talking a lot about AI, and they are saying effectively that there are going to be thousands, actually Goldman Sachs, who feature very heavily here, along with the all the big banks, basically, are saying something like 300 million jobs are going to be lost due to AI. But so what do you make of this kind of so-called leap forward in technology? It does seem like it's another kind of poison chalice.
It's a sort of leap sideways, actually. I mean, the idea that's being sold is that AI is going to produce people sort of like a super intelligence. But of course, it's not going to produce a super intelligence, but it is going to produce a super intelligent system for controlling people. That's what it's for. It's a bit like the printing press, you know. So what you had before was people believed in God and so forth, and then you printed the Bible, and then they thought they had to think differently. And then people were writing things that they could read and they could then think differently. And the point with AI is that it has the ability, because it is so monstrously powerful in terms of thinking velocity, thinking speed, is that it can examine data and come to some conclusion about the data, which an ordinary human being would just not be able to do, you know, in the time available. So it can respond very quickly to changes in ideas and so forth, and it can then pump this stuff back into the human race to stupidify people. And of course, it will do that. And so the point is that the way in which we think now is we think through the internet. We look at videos and we look at this and we look at that. AI can make a video. AI can make a video in which Joe Biden comes out and says something extremely intelligent, and you think, oh my goodness me, what an intelligent man. Oh, we must vote for him. That kind of thing. That's where AI is going to be dangerous. It's going to be extremely dangerous. And people like Musk and other people who've developed the AI and so on are all screaming and yelling and freaking out about it all, and they're quite right to do that. But the idea of AI somehow getting us to a Terminator society where the machines take over, I think that's unlikely myself. But I, you know, it is quite frightening. And of course, the work, you know, quite so. All people will not people who work won't be needed anymore. They don't have to make decisions because AI will make decisions. But those decisions will make a difference to the way in which the world moves.
So there's Dr. Chris Busby there saying effectively he thinks that the AI, Charlie, is going to be a method to control humanity. He's saying it's not actually about letting you off the leash and the AI will do all your thinking for you. It's going to, well, yes, it's going to do your thinking for you, but it's certainly not going to teach you what's best for you. It's a form of slavery, effectively.
Well, I mean, that danger is even addressed by some of the biggest adherents of it, like Eric Schmidt. So he talks about the fact that, you know, you'll have at some point an AI assistant that will tell you stuff and all the time and go, you should be doing this, maybe you think about doing that, oh, and perhaps you should do this. But obviously, and he obviously raises the point, who gets to say what the AI assistant tells you to do? And, you know, you keep sort of outsourcing so much of your thinking and doing to AI that it's hard to see what you're left with. That's why I don't know if you're aware of that Saudi Arabian megacity Neom that's being sort of built, or at least being talked about being built in the Saudi Arabian desert. Vast enterprise, and it's all this, everything's smart and AI powered. But the kind of vision of this post work world that they give you is really eerie. You kind of basically just sort of go jet skiing, and then you sort of walk around a mall and then have your foot massage, and then you go and sit and have a picnic. You know, it's like it's slightly infantilizing everyone, because there isn't really anything left for us to do.
Well, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? But of course, if you don't have any assets, you don't have any sort of skin in that game, do you? You know, you're able to enjoy yourself, but you're not able to criticize the system that lets you enjoy yourself. I remember there's an old book I read as a teenager, The Dancers at the End of Time, by Michael Moorcock, and he talks about a sort of ultimate society there where people can do what they want, but actually they're all rather bored. And there is a sort of various fake versions of history that they use to entertain themselves with.
Well, that reminds me of I read once the book by the divine Richard Baxter called The Saints' Everlasting Rest, and I was struck by this is a large, laid out vision of heaven, and I just remember thinking, this is so boring. There's nothing to do here. All you do is sing hymns all day long, because everything else is essentially taken away from you, all the possible things that you might do in your kind of limited fleshly existence.
Okay, well, I'm hoping we're joined by Federico. Are you there, Federico Carvalho?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me well?
Yes, that's fine. So could you tell us what your experience so far has been like with the Bilderberg? Have you met any Bilderbergers, and who do you think's here? What's going on?
Well, I was yesterday in the airport all day, along with a few fellows here following the Bilderberg, and we were able to capture them in camera arriving to the airport, so we have a pretty good pictures of many of them. The Austrian Minister of Foreign Affairs, for instance, a very interesting Alexander Schatzberger. So, but what I got from the low-level sort of thing, big shots that we got, is the big ones that worry me more. And you will be talking AI, I would like to talk about the war. I think they are warmongers here, because we have not only the General Secretary of NATO, but you also have the General of the military here, the Supreme Commander of European Forces, which is a very direct sign that maybe they are talking not about peace, but about war, going into war, which is very worrisome for the world. I'm here already by the hotel. It's very calm and peaceful. The garden, there is no demonstration whatsoever, just a few policemen. The sun is almost setting here in Lisbon, which is quite nice. And the thing is, more appalling, is that I read in the newspaper saying there's a high risk of security. Well, some of the Bilderberg members, they are walking by also, or the security walking by. There is no one to threaten them, because the biggest threat to the world is inside of the building, not outside. We don't want to make harm to them. We just want to know what the hell they want to do to us outside.
Yeah, fascinating. And I think Charlie will corroborate. It's really good that you've brought up this idea of the warmongers inside, because this is maybe why some of the participants don't feel entirely comfortable in there. We've got evidence from previous conferences. I remember in 2002 at Versailles, Jim Tucker speaking with one of the hotel staff after the conference had finished, who told him that they were discussing invading Iraq at the bar. He'd overheard them. And everyone at the time said, don't be ridiculous. Of course, a year later, one of the most horrific invasions in history began.
So I don't know if we will have the chance of talking to someone that overheard the conversation in the bar, but you just need to listen to the parents of the journalists that then repeat what their boss is about to repeat here or listen or to decide. Although they say, we don't take any decisions. Well, the decisions may be already taken in other places. They just come here to confirm that everybody's okay with whatever decision is already being taken. Well, many people ask me, what is the plan? And I say to them, I think there is no plan. They are just going along planning their stuff. And that's why every year they have this kind of meeting, like a team building for their playground, which is the world. And we are just a little pawns on their hands, basically like that. Otherwise, it will be transparent. It would be easier. It would be no security. Come on.
So at the airport, did you have any conversations with any of the participants, and did you manage to spot any people coming into the city who were not on the list?
You don't need. Well, there were people doing confrontations, and they tried to have them a reaction, but the reaction is always no comment, no comment, no comment. Okay, of course. What my presence in the airport as a journalist and taking the pictures of them arriving is just to confirm that the list is okay. Many of the names that I saw, and then I have to Google their faces because they are international, 130, I know them all. And, now I know I have them in pictures, and maybe in the future I will send them an email asking, sir, could you please tell to the world, to us as a journalist, what is your vision to the world that they have the solution? Why are you not able to resolve all the situations in the world as a wise man meeting in the top of a mountain?
Well, look, you know, you took a picture, didn't you? You took a photograph of Yuval Noah Harari. Yuval Noah Harari. I mean, we've got all over the news this week problems with AI, artificial intelligence, and yet he's here, but he's not on the list.
Well, Yuval is coincidentally in Lisbon. He is going to make a speech tonight. Okay, that's public. Yuval is in Lisbon.
Just pure coincidence.
Coincidentally, with this meeting, maybe it is just a pure coincidence. But the moment that you have someone like that, you can say, "Well, and while you're here, why don't you want to come here?"
Well, exactly. And look, maybe, the photograph.
Say, no, but Fred, he doesn't need to go here. Everybody knows already.
Federico, the photograph you took of him made it. He looked a little bit guilty. He was looking like he really didn't want to be seen. Anyway, Charlie's going to have to go now. But Charlie, can you tell us a little bit about this guy? Because he's one of the most famous writers in the world, Yuval Noah Harari. He's thinking about humans as hackable animals, human 2.0. And he's actually there saying, we need to really regulate this world, otherwise it can get out of control. A lot of people around the world, particularly even the military now, saying exactly the same thing. So maybe he's got his finger on the pulse.
Well, he's like a slightly sexier Nick Bostrom, who is the Oxford guy who talks a lot about the kind of existential threat of AI. But Harari's kind of turned it on its head, and everything is almost a positive with him. It's just like, here we go into this glorious future. So rather than saying, look, you know, here are the 17 ways that AI can destroy us, he's just like, here are the ways that it can enhance us. And you know, like a bit like Thingamabob from Google, whose name I've forgotten, who
Kurzweil,
exactly,
Kurzweil,
yes, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like a Kurzweil 2.0.
Okay. Final word from you, Federico. Oh, he's disappeared. Okay, so he's gone.
That allows me in that gap to tell you about Balsamão, the former Portuguese Prime Minister, who turned up at the gates and was held by security, even though all of the policemen must have known who he was. And he's a former, you know, Bilderberg Steering Committee member. I remember him out on the patio, having a smoke, surrounded by women.
When you say held at the gates,
his car. I mean, just for quite a while, considering who he is. He went inside for apparently the current Portuguese Prime Minister, Costa, was arriving for lunch. So he turned up for that. So he's on the participant list, but I'm not sure he was participating much. He didn't look like he could.
All right, thanks, Charlie. We're going to hear now from actually Martin. Why don't you just give us your thoughts on what you've just been hearing?
Well, I mean, you're obviously sniffing around there and trying to see what's going on. I think the point made by Federico that they're talking about war in there is extremely to the point, because the war in the Ukraine is reaching a crisis point, and it's not at all clear that the Western powers know what to do. So they're probably, you know, knocking heads together to try and work out what they're going to do.
It's great the way Federico put his finger on it. Warmongering, Martin. Really, this is a way that you can start a war and try and keep out of the public eye. It's very interesting as well what you were saying about Mrs. Kravis from the Modern Art Museum in New York actually saying, no, I'm not looking forward to it. You know, this is that's exactly the sort of atmosphere that there is in there, a kind of attempt to ramp up the war in Ukraine. And we've got the Ukrainian foreign minister sitting in there too.
I think the problem they've got politically at this moment is that they are losing the war in Ukraine and they don't know what to do about it other than doubling down. And, you know, you can imagine there's quite angsty discussions going on because things are not necessarily going their way. And they're not really sure what to do about it all. And you can see that that probably would lead to some quite complex and difficult discussions going on. It's not as if they're planning a war like the planning of the war in Iraq in 2002. They're in the middle of one and they're losing and they don't know what to do about it.
Well, it's not the first time, is it? I mean, we've seen lose scenarios. This seems to be the modus operandi. In many of these wars, the intervention is to go in there, cause all sorts of trouble, maybe blow a few things up, make money. This is disaster capitalism out of the reconstruction. I mean, we're talking here about things like the intervention in Libya, in Iraq. There are many, many other countries where you could go back as far as Vietnam, Martin. That the Americans lost there too.
That's true, and in many ways, the military-industrial complex is not that bothered about losing the odd war as long as they make enough money out of it. But the problem with this war is that it isn't any old war. It's for all the marbles. And if they lose it, their system, the NATO deep state system in the West, could be severely damaged. That doesn't mean that they don't intend to lose. They're trying to find ways to square the circle here. But, the defeat by the Vietnamese did not threaten the fundamentals of the world capitalist system. A defeat in the Ukraine, on the other hand, and of course the economic sanctions around that, and I saw in the G7 that they're talking about having extra sanctions on Russia. Britain is not going to buy their diamonds, would you believe? But they're thrashing around to try and come up with some kind of strategy, because in actual fact, it's quite possible that things are just going to go down the tubes for them quite rapidly.
Okay, so we're coming up to the break now. But before we go into the break, I thought it'd be sad to announce the death of a chap called Dave Barmby. Dave came on our program, as you probably remember, Martin, way back in 2012. We had some fascinating discussions about a guy called Desmond Morton, but particularly about a battle which involved Lord Carrington, who then became not only the chairman of the Bilderberg conferences back in the 1990s and early noughties, but also the Secretary General of NATO. And he was involved in this battle in the Second World War. And I'd like to play you a little recording of Dave, who sadly died aged 82 last week. And his funeral was this week. I think he actually died, at the end of last week. And he was one of the people that's really did so much to help me to get to the bottom of what Bilderberg's all about and how actually it is entirely tied in with the Nazi project. So here we are at Nijmegen Bridge, Wednesday, 20th of September, 1944, and back to a programme that we did back in on the 16th of March, 2012, with the late, great Dave Barmby giving us all this information about exactly how the Bilderberg fits in with the Nazi project.
The second of the three bridges was captured, and then there was a whole debacle, wasn't there, between the Americans and the British. The British being the tanks, basically, at least attempting anyway to make that last step to Arnhem.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, reading all the accounts, and that's all we can do, we weren't there, so we can only sit down as armchair generals. I think what happened, deducing, is that four tanks led by Sergeant Robinson went across the bridge at the behest of his commanding officer, which was Major Trotter, and he went across the bridge with four tanks, got across to the other side of the bridge and carried on another mile to Lent. And he talked about meeting the Americans at the bridge, and I'd always thought it was the railway bridge, and it was actually a railway bridge over the Vaal, but it was actually a railway bridge over the road in Lent, a mile on, and they're only 8 miles from Arnhem at that stage, and it was only later that Carrington, who was second in command of the squadron, which
this is Lord Carrington, who was Defence Secretary later, wasn't he?
Well, he was not only he was certainly Foreign Secretary. He may have been Defence Secretary, but he was also Secretary General of NATO in the 80s. He was also, for 6 years, Chairman of the Bilderbergers.
So he was sitting in one of these tanks that had just got across, the first tanks to cross the penultimate bridge before Arnhem, when he was confronted by Moffat Burries and a load of American soldiers. So let's just listen now to a little clip from Robert E. Levine's film A Bridge Too Far, which portrays this little incident where the Americans were essentially saying, look guys, don't hang around here, you need to get off up to Arnhem. So let's have a listen to that now.
I don't understand, why aren't you moving? What's the matter with you guys?
Those are British troops at Arnhem. They're hurt bad. You're not going to stop. Not now.
I'm sorry, we have our orders.
We busted our asses getting here, half my men are killed, and you're just going to stop and drink tea?
Look, we're now facing a completely different situation. We can't leave with tanks up that road. Jerry will pick us off like sitting ducks. Our infantry are still fighting in Nijmegen. When they get here, we'll move on.
For Christ's sake, must you do everything but a book?
Our orders are to wait for the infantry. I'm sorry, but there it is.
Yes, that was the confrontation portrayed in the film, A Bridge Too Far. Now, Moffat Burries was one of the people in charge of that river crossing and lost about half of his men. Yeah. And he's still alive, isn't he? He also wrote a book called Strike and Hold.
Yeah, I've got that book here, actually.
I've interviewed Moffat Burries. I managed to get hold of him in the States. So let's have a listen now to him, who was there, his version of what happened.
My name is Moffat Burries. I was a captain in 3rd Battalion, 504 Parachute Regiment, and commanded I Company, which is one of the two assault companies that made the river crossing and captured the bridge at Nijmegen. When we were first advised that we were going to be in that battle, we went up in this tall building, a factory electrical plant building, with General Horrocks and General Browning, Colonel Tucker, and the officers from the four company commanders of the S3 of the 3rd Battalion 504, and made a visual reconnaissance and looking over the river and over the pasture and the dike where the machine guns were, railroad bridge where the 20mm gun was. And I remember General Horrocks explaining the critical situation of the British troops in Arnhem, and that if we didn't get there and give them some assistance at the bridge, that in a matter of hours, all would be lost. And I remember Colonel Tucker responding to a comment that General Horrocks made when he said, General Horrocks asked Tucker, can your lads do the job? Can they get the bridge? Colonel Tucker said, let me ask you a question, General. If we take that bridge, what assurance do we have from you that your tanks will be lined up for Arnhem in force? And Horrocks, and I can remember his remarks as if they were yesterday, said, my tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem, and nothing will stop them. That's not what happened. One gun stopped them. When the after we crossed the river and had 50% casualties in that crossing, and made it up to the dike, knocked out the machine guns, and went on and captured the north end of the bridge. Four British tanks came across. The lead tank was knocked out, and the other three backed up to the bridge. And I went to the commander of that task force, which was Captain Carrington, and said, "Why are you stopping?" And he said, "Well, I can't go up there. That gun will knock out the rest of my tanks." I said, "We will go with you and get that gun." He said, "No, I can't go without orders." And I said, "Well, I'm giving you orders." And an American captain giving a British captain orders went over like a lead balloon. And so he said, "No, I have to have orders from my British commander. Well, about that time, my frustration was turning to anger, and I can't repeat on the air what I said to him at that time, but it was not very complimentary, and they sat there all night, even after Colonel Tucker and Major Cook came and had a similar conversation with him. "Why aren't you moving on? There's only one gun left." And what I couldn't understand, just a few hours before that, Horrocks had told us very explicitly, "My tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem." Four tanks went across. Not all of his tanks. Not 10, not 20, not 40 tanks, but four tanks went across. And when one got knocked out, they backed up and stopped. Why did they do that? I don't know. The information I have been told was that Carrington said his orders were to take the bridge and hold it for further orders. That was not what Horrocks told us the orders would be. So we were very, very frustrated sitting there all night, having sacrificed half of the men of my company to try to rescue the British paratroopers. We knew what it was like for paratroopers to fight Tiger tanks. We'd done it all through Sicily and Italy and the rest of the war, and it is not a comfortable feeling. So we had a great deal of compassion for the British paratroopers that were being mauled by the Tiger tanks. To send four tanks across, and he has an entire corps of tanks in Nijmegen, is just beyond belief. We were expecting to see the tanks roaring across the bridge at full speed, and that didn't happen. I can understand the 10 tanks that were supporting us when we were making the river crossing. Maybe I'd been told they were not there because they had expended all of their ammunition. But the rest of the tanks that were in Nijmegen, there should have been a full force of them going across that bridge and headed for Arnhem. The airborne paratroopers in Arnhem were just hanging on by their fingernails, and that was known by Horrocks and the other troops in Nijmegen. And why they would let that one gun stop them is just beyond belief to me.
That was Captain Moffat T. Burris, author of Strike and Hold, and who was commanding a company that made that famous Vaal crossing. Dave, you know, his testimony there is pretty much, he was there, you know, and he's saying essentially that no one could really believe. Do you think it's possible that maybe that the generals told him that they were going to be charging up the road in order to sort of get him going to do the crossing in the first place?
Well, I, that doesn't really make sense, because if that's all they wanted him to do, cross the river and not do anything about it, why send him in the first place? Or at least, if you're not going to do anything about the following up on his success, or Moffat Burris and the rest of the companies, that was H&I company, then why not do it at night, where you'd reduce casualties to a minimal amount? But the fact is, there was no follow-up, and this is a big black hole that remains to be understood.
Well, I pressed Moffat Burrows a bit on the confrontation with Carrington, because there's a lot of rumours around that. This is Lord Carrington sitting in his Grenadier Guards tank, as Moffat Burrows, having lost half his company, comes up and sees him sitting there when he really does expect him to go charging down the road. So let's see what Moffat Burrows had to say about that.
I was talking to Carrington, he was sitting in his tank, and we were having this argument about him not moving out, and when he failed to move, and I ordered him to, and he still failed to move, I cocked my Tommy gun and put it to his head and told him if he didn't get this blankety-blank tank moving, I'd blow his head off. And with that, he ducks down into the tank, closes the hatch, and sits there the rest of the night, couldn't get to him. As I understand, Carrington denies that anybody pulled a gun on him, but his memory is not quite as good as mine if he really believes that. I bumped into Carrington at the 65th anniversary celebration at a reception that we're having for the Queen. And as he walked up, General Petraeus was and I were talking, and he introduced me to Carrington, and I said, well, we know each other. We met on the bridge 65 years ago. And Carrington turned and looked at me, and he said, oh, you're the chap that called me a yellow-livered coward. And I said, is that what I called you? And he said, yes. And I said, you didn't really expect me to follow the orders of a foreign government, did you? And I said, of course I did. And then it went on to some small talk from that point.
That's Moffat Burrows again, who's a veteran of that campaign. Dave, what do you think about what Carrington's putting there? I mean, just to make it clear, I did actually put an interview request into the House of Lords to see if Lord Carrington wanted to contribute, but didn't get any reply. What he's saying there, Moffat Burrows, is essentially on what Carrington is saying, is that it's a foreign army. Why should I take orders from a captain, even though he's the same rank as me? He's from the American army, not the British army.
Well, I would have expected that there would have been cooperation, that Carrington would have seen the effort that had been put in and the deaths and that happened to half of the his company and the other company that were crossed over, and he would have played ball.
So that's the voice of Dave Barmby, who died last week, aged 82, who was a major contributor to my book, The Traitors of Arnhem. In fact, even some of the editions of it's on the spine, it says that Dave is the author of the book. And in many ways he was, because him coming to me with all this information about the Battle of Arnhem, the subsequent extension of the war, giving the Nazis enough time to squirrel away their wealth in places like Argentina, Switzerland, etc., and then to carry on the Nazi project through the Dulles Brothers law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, and Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, to create a kind of financial Fourth Reich after the war. That was the outcome of that. And, of course, the Bilderberg conferences started in Oosterbeek in that same area, which was called the Witch's Cauldron, the Hexenkessel, where the British were being massacred in Arnhem. Martin, do you want to give us your sort of military view of this? Because it does seem as if there is this kind of very, very strong connection between what the Nazis were up to and a kind of power afterwards that has been documented by people like John Ainsworth Davis and Paul Manning.
Well, I don't know if I can give a military point of view. I can give a point of view. I think the investigative research you've done into this topic and shows that the word deals being done between elements within the Nazi state and the incoming not NATO powers but Western powers. And of course this was pretty obvious from the get-go, from wider things that happened, such as the appointment of Reinhard Gehlen, who'd headed up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, to be the head of the BND, the
West
German.
Yeah, but we kind of knew, Martin, about the connections between the US and the SS. You know, for example, the United States thing, Operation Paperclip, the idea of Wernher von Braun actually being part of the US space program and that sort of thing. Obviously, they wanted these rockets in order to be able to dominate space, to be able to fire intercontinental ballistic missiles across the world. But the link between Desmond Morton, Churchill's private secretary, and Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, was pretty obscure, wasn't it?
Well, it is obscure, and it's only, you know, the book by Paul Manning, of course, who's a senior US journalist about Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is linked also to the other book that you've mentioned, Op JB, by John Ainsworth Davis.
And absolutely extraordinary that you've got the chairman of Bilderberg for the first 20 years, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, being a major figure in that Arnhem battle, who was a former SS officer, and briefing various people, it looks now as if just simply waltzed into Holland to give the Abwehr warning that the battle was about to take place. And after the war, of course, he's rewarded with this key job as the chairman of Bilderberg for the first 20 years.
Well, after the Battle of the Falaise Gap in Normandy, it seems that the German industrialists had a meeting. I can't remember. Was it in Strasbourg, the Red House meeting? This is all in the John Ainsworth Davis's book, because of course he was a British agent.
It's also in Paul Manning's book.
In other words, at that point, which is before the Battle of Arnhem, there's already deals being done, not with the Nazi state as a whole, but with any elements within that state. And it seems to me that the Battle of Arnhem was deliberately thrown so that the Nazis, like Bormann in particular and others associated with him, could be integrated into a follow-on setup at the end of the war. And don't forget, by this stage, they're already thinking about what the next war is going to be about. It's against the Soviet Union and everything that it stands for. And that, this is the justification for all this kind of kid gloves approach to former Nazis, is at the end of the day, we've now got another enemy, and they are the real enemy. Of course, Marshal Zhukov, who was the head of the Soviet armed forces, said, "We have liberated Europe from Nazism, and they're never going to forgive us." And that's a quote that's quite frequently brought up in political discourse in Russia today.
Finally, let's point out that, in a way, the Bilderberg Conference is a kind of in-joke amongst the Nazis. You know, this was a battle, and, you know, chatting to the people who live in Arnhem and Oosterbeek, they're actually really, you know, certainly the people, that anyone that can remember the war, they're really upset about the way that the whole Arnhem anniversary has been turned into a kind of celebration of a Nazi victory. Unbelievable, really. And the in-joke with Bilderberg is that this is one of the key moments in which we made sure that the Fourth Reich was going to be successful after World War II. And these individuals like Lord Carrington, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who all both of them became Bilderberg chairman. That's what it was all about. So anyway, look, let's wind up our chat about Bilderberg for the time being, because we're going to come back in a minute and have a look at this incredible story about the arms dump in Western Ukraine, which sent, it seems, a plume of gamma radiation heading towards Poland, in the most horrific irony that the British, by sending this DU ammunition into Ukraine, may have actually created a absolute radiation storm over in neighbouring Poland. So we'll hear that after our musical break.
Let us continue in prayer that the life of the Trinity may flow into our lives in creative hope, active service, and joyful praise. In the days following the coronation, we pray for our King and our nation. Almighty God, who set your Son upon a heavenly throne where we worship him as the King of Kings, we pray for Charles, our King, that you may pour upon him abundant gifts, that he might fulfill the promises made at his coronation. May he have the grace, wisdom, and strength to live a life of service to you and to his people. And may our celebration of this coronation lead to a renewed offering of ourselves in the service of our nation, our communities, and one another. We pray for the life and work of this cathedral and for the city of Bristol, where our maritime history includes the shameful trade in enslaved and trafficked Africans. As we face the challenge of the legacy of slavery and the impact of racism in the church and the wider community, we pray for humility, repentance, and hope. O God, who longs for the flourishing of all, may this cathedral community be strengthened in its longing to be a place where all your children are welcomed. As we acknowledge the impact of the legacy of slavery on our building and the sin of racism that stains our relationships with our neighbours, give us humility and courage to repair the damage of the past, to challenge injustice in our own time, and to look forward in hope to the day when your beloved community can live together in unity and mutual affection. And so we sum up all our prayers, saying together, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Ghost, be with us all evermore. Amen.
Not tonight, not tonight. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Not tonight. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Not tonight. You're not on the list. Tonight, you're not on the list. Not tonight, you're not on the list. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Not tonight. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Your name's not down, you're not coming in.
Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy, defend us from all perils and dangers of this night. For the love of thy only Son, our Saviour Jesus Christ.
Thank you. short intermission. We'll see you in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, so that's from 1974, Joni Mitchell in her Miles of Isles album, a live version of the wonderful Woodstock. I think that was on the, well, her the album I remember so well is Blue from Joni, and she's still just about around. I think she's not too well. Maybe we can offer up a prayer for her. I hope she's doing okay. And that's the Woodstock song, but a live version of it, the one that was played at the Woodstock Festival, and really a kind of appeal for us to put the world back on track. So we started there with the Choral Evensong from 3 o'clock live last Sunday in Bristol Cathedral. And then we had the Bouncer, Kicks Like a Mule, from 1992, and that one, Miles of Ours with Joni Mitchell, Woodstock, was from 1974. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, live from Lisbon in Portugal for the Bilderberg Conference 2023, which we've been having fun in trying to untangle what's going on inside. Martin, we're going to start by looking in part two at this story to do with, well, you mentioned that you'd seen a bit about it, you weren't really sure. Well, neither was I, about a massive explosion in western Ukraine where the Russians hitting an arms dump, which it looks like may have contained quite a lot of this depleted uranium ammunition. Now, of course, this sort of thing could be just complete nonsense as fake news. But, you know, you would expect, wouldn't you, that if a story like this gone out there, that there would at least be some sort of interrogation, even if it was to say, no, it didn't happen, because the implications for, you know, large explosions involving DU ammunition are pretty horrific for whoever's standing in the way. This is like a kind of dirty bomb, effectively.
Well, as you say, I mean, there's all throughout this war, there's been all sorts of rumours circulating, and it's been quite difficult to distinguish fact from fiction, especially from a distance. But if it is the case that the Russians have blown up a load of British DU ammunition, then you can see why they'd have done that. We're not waiting till you truck this ammunition to the front line to knock out our tanks. We're going to blow it up in the warehouse. Quite straightforward. And, of course, it's in Lviv, or Lvov, as it used to be called when it was under Polish rule, and when I was visiting it when it was part of the Soviet Union. And if you're going to spread DU around, you want it to be spread around in the West Ukraine where your enemies are rather than the East Ukraine where your friends are. So well, they can deal with it.
It's very difficult to pronounce. I mean, actually, Chris Busby, we're about to hear from, does pronounce it pretty well. Kleminlinsky, something like that, which is very close
to it's named after a Cossack leader from the 16th century who led the Cossacks. They weren't Ukrainians, they were Cossacks, they actually emigrated from Russia, against the Polish landlords who used to dominate what is now Ukraine. And he was actually, in order to fight the Polish landlords, this guy Kleminski, I think it is, had to align with Moscow. So the fact that he's made into a Ukrainian hero because he was a Cossack, he was aligned with Moscow to fight the Poles. Because, of course, the Ukrainians, historically, the people that oppressed them were the Poles, which is why they massacred so many in the Second World War.
So many ironies in this attack, then. You know, if this was a place which was commemorating the sort of anti-Polish elements in there, because, of course, this potential... I mean, I looked at this story and I thought, well, gamma radiation and DU don't really go together. And that's what was detected, apparently. And I was put straight by this, by Dr. Chris Busby, as he talks now about, this is around about 20 minutes, but he needs that 20 minutes, Chris, to go into the physics of exactly what has been going on. So we'll have a listen now to Dr. Chris Busby talking about this alleged Polish gamma ray plume and why I... looking at it and thinking, well, actually, DU doesn't produce gamma radiation. It's mainly alpha radiation, so this looks like fake news. Why I was completely wrong about that.
I'm Christopher Busby. I've been interested for 30 years in the health effects of ionizing radiation, and particularly have focused on the effects of uranium, depleted uranium. I studied depleted uranium in Kosovo, where I visited there with Nippon TV, and I also went to Iraq with Al Jazeera and looked at the effects of depleted uranium. And I've written three scientific papers on the effects of depleted uranium in Iraq, in Fallujah, and then also countless articles and, you know, so forth. So I would consider myself an international expert on depleted uranium and what it is and how it affects people in terms of their health and genetic damage and so forth.
Now, so we've recently heard about a spike in gamma detection in Europe. Can you just take us through this a bit, like explain a bit about what is gamma radiation and why you think it might be linked to depleted uranium? Because for most people who even have a basic understanding of radiation, DU is not a gamma emitter. It doesn't emit gamma rays. So it does sound quite counterintuitive as to whether this could even be related to depleted uranium, which the British amazingly have been proud to be supplying to the Ukrainian army.
Well, we'll start with the gamma radiation. There are three types of radiation, basically. There's gamma radiation, which is like light. It's a very sort of powerful form of light in terms of its energy, and it goes right through the body. But on its way through the body, some of it's absorbed and can damage the DNA, and then that leads to cancer and all sorts of other downstream effects. Then there's beta radiation, which are basically electrons, and they have a range in air of about a meter at most, maybe a little bit more or less, depending upon which beta it is, which energy it is. And then there's alpha radiation, which is an alpha particle, which is when the nuclide decays, it gives off a particle which has a very short range in air, about 3 centimeters, something like that, and it can't penetrate the skin. And so from the point of view of external radiation, it's not really very dangerous. It can't, but if it gets inside you, it's highly ionizing because it's a very short range and it deposits all its energy in a very short range, about the range of about 4 cells. So in theory, internal alpha emitters, and uranium is one of them, can cause massive damage to the cells that close to the decay. In the case of uranium, the alpha emission from the particles will cause an increased dose rate close to the particle. So the particles below about 3 microns in diameter are effectively a gas, they're aerosols, because they're so small. They just float about in the air, and you can inhale them, then they go into your lung, then they go into your lymphatic system, and effectively they can get anywhere. And once they lodge somewhere, then of course they keep banging away with their emissions, and so that area becomes much more damaged in terms of its dose. Now, dose is energy per unit mass, and so the way in which this is analysed by governments and by the risk model that we have at the moment, that's basically the International Commission on Radiological Protection, it dishonestly dilutes the energy into the whole organ. This is something that was decided in the 1970s in order to cover the effects of these alpha emitters like plutonium that were being produced in large amounts in the nuclear weapons testing and in the development of nuclear weapons in America and in England, places like Aldermaston. Anyway, in England and various places in America where they make the bombs. So I was on the Depleted Uranium Oversight Board of the Ministry of Defense in around about 2000-2004. Michael Meacher put me on that committee, and I also gave evidence to the Royal Society. But following all of that, they still maintained that you could dilute this energy, alpha energy, into the organ. And so people who were exposed to uranium were supposed to have an extremely small dose. And dose is the problem. It's fairly meaningless when it comes to internal radiation. I was also on a British government committee called the Committee Examining Radiation Risks from Internal Emitters, which sat for about 4 years at the beginning of 2004. But that was shut down as soon as it started to find something. Misha was sacked as the environment minister by Tony Blair. So they produced a dishonest report. And we produced a minority report, myself and Bramhall, because we were the only people on the committee that held these radiation effects from alpha emitters, from alpha emitting particles, particularly uranium, were problematical. Of course, there was a huge amount of evidence that they were. So if you go to Kosovo, when we did do that, and we looked at the evidence from Kosovo, from the military people there, in the Italian military and Portuguese military and so on, and also in Iraq, where you saw these effects in children and cancer in adults, enormous increases in cancer in adults. So what you have here is an epidemiological problem. You have a problem in which on the one level, you have a theory, this is like the risk model, that says that these things are harmless on the basis of what you would call deduction. So they start with dose, and they say, oh, the dose is very small, therefore they can't have an effect. And so when they see the effect, they say there is no effect, and so they just cover it up. And attempts to publish all of this stuff in the peer-review literature were blocked and blocked and blocked and blocked. Okay. Let's go forward now to Khmelnytsky, which is a very large explosion that occurred. This is a place sort of halfway, it's to the west of Kiev, it's sort of halfway between Kiev and the border with Poland, slightly south of west. And there was an attack with a missile attack by the Russians on what they said was an arms dump there. And photos appeared on the internet of an explosion, or a few explosions, right? Two main explosions, which were absolutely massive. When you look at them, and I've seen pictures of similar explosions in Lebanon, and what they show is a black cloud. So there's almost like a nuclear explosion, but it's not a nuclear explosion. There's a big fireball, and it moves upwards, and you get a mushroom cloud with a lot of black soot, if you like, or black particles, and then they drift away. Well, there was it immediately we began hearing on the internet, we who follow these things in Ukraine, that there was a big radiation spike associated with this. Okay. And later on, yes, saw that.
Interrupt you, but do we know when this was? We got it where, but what about
14th, on the 14th of May. And so what happened is that later on I saw that the Ukrainians were clearing out the debris, and they were putting out the fires with robots. So they had these robot machines. So the question you have to ask is why they were using robot machines to clear out the fire generally sort of cover things up. There were no firemen people there. They were robot sort of machinery, German machinery it was, like little tracked vehicles blowing water, I suppose, mostly. Anyway, so that's a little piece of evidence. You have to put all these bits of evidence together. But let's just go back now to the alphas, betas, and so on. The fact is that although uranium, depleted uranium as U-238, that's what it is, they take out the nuclear fissile component, which is U-235, and that leaves a U-238 rich material, which they use in the weapons to fire at the tanks. And it's jolly effective, I can tell you, because I've seen the tanks that have been hit by this stuff. When it hits the tank, it burns, and it burns through the tank and produces all this black smoke, which then floats all over the place. Floats over very large distances, incidentally, because it's a gas, as I said earlier. Okay, so the question is, why gamma? Well, the answer is that uranium has two daughters. So you have to know, if you know the physics, that uranium-238 decays to two isotopes, thorium-234 and protoactinium-234M. They go blip, blip, like that. The half-life of the thorium-234 is about 20 days, and the other one's a few minutes. And then it goes to uranium-234. So So when you get a piece of DU, what you've got there is you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 isotopes are all in stochastic equilibrium. So for every blip you get from an alpha emission from U238, you get a beta emission blip from thorium-234 and another beta emission blip from protoactinium-234M, and then you get the uranium-234, which has quite a long half-life, but even so, it is there. All right, so effectively, when you get a decay from uranium-238, you get blip, 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 like that. It's called stochastic equilibrium. Now, the second two of those are both gamma emitters. They're very weak gamma emitters, but they are gamma emitters. The thorium-234 is the main one that has a gamma emission energy, which comes with the beta that it shoots out. So when it shoots out the beta, it also shoots out a gamma ray. And 6% of all the decays are gamma. So that means if you go anywhere near uranium-238, you will get gamma. And in fact, you can find it like that. So when I was wandering around Iraq, you know, with a Geiger counter, and other people have gone with Geiger counters, and they've looked at tanks that have been hit by these things, and you put the Geiger counter near the tank, and it goes mad. It screams, you know. There's a lot of gamma because there's a lot of uranium. So although uranium is a very weak emitter, has a very long half-life, 4.5 billion years, it is associated with a gamma ray, and the gamma ray can be picked up. So that's the first thing. So the people that say it's only an alpha emitter and how could it be this and that and all these excuses that are made about how this spike can be nothing to do with uranium, these are cover-ups. And I noticed the Russians also are covering it up. So what we've got with there was a Russian physicist that I've seen talking on YouTube or one of these video channels, I think Telegram. And he's saying that, oh, well, you know, uranium doesn't burn. He says that uranium melts at 1,400 degrees. And even if there was, he said, well, we did hit the thing. And if there was uranium there, it would just all go up in the air and come down again. There would be no uranium in any smoke. Well, that is a lie. And if he's a physicist, he should know that's a lie. So that's another piece of evidence that they're trying to cover this up. Of course, the Russians don't want everyone to freak out and blame them for contaminating Poland. I mean, this is what's happened. Okay, back to what's happened. I was contacted by a few people asking me the same question that you're asking me, and I thought, well, let's go and have a look. So what I managed to do was to go to the EuroDep website, which is the first thing I do, where they have all these detectors all over Europe, which they set up after the Chernobyl accident in order to make sure that nobody was going to get surprised anymore when some power station blew up. And what I found immediately is that the website was down. That is to say, it was there, but it wouldn't give you any information. So you asked, you went to one of the points, they had a map there, and you click on one of the places on the map, and it sort of says it says loading and loading and loading, and just ran on and on and on and on loading. So it wouldn't give you any info. But then someone sent me one graph that had been taken before all this stuff happened. And then I got talking to them, and they'd managed to download a few graphs. So various people sent me graphs of the different sites in Poland. And what they all showed was an enormous increase round about the beginning, over the 15th, right? So then I went to have a look at the historic weather data, and I looked at the pressure map. I'm a yachtsman, so I know how to interpret atmospheric pressure maps. And what they showed was there was a big anticyclone sitting over the north of Ukraine and over Europe. The weather was quite good, sunny weather, you know, not raining and so on. And the weather and the wind was blowing from Klemnitsky to the northwest. So that in other words, it was blowing, but very slow, very gently. It wasn't any strong wind. It was a very gentle wind, you know, a few knots. And it blew, and it was blowing the remnants of the explosion. It was blowing across into Poland. And of course, basically up through Poland into Germany and then up into the Baltic states and across the whole of Europe, because it then curves around, because you've got a low pressure system to the left of that, so that picks it up and takes it over the top of the low pressure system and back down into Europe through England into France and so forth. So the stuff's coming here, whatever it is. All right. So then we look at Poland, and what we find is that every single detector in Poland goes up suddenly in the middle of the 15th, but you know, at different times. So the times are depend upon how far they are from Chmielnicki, and the highest effect is a Polish detector on the border. So then the question is, well, what is it? Now, one thing, and you have to be careful, one thing that it could be is radon. I mean, when it rains, when there's a pressure differential, you know, big pressure differential, like a frontal system comes in and there's a lot of rain, you get what's called a radon spike, because there's a natural gas that's emitted from radium, which is radium is in the ground, and the radon is in the ground. And so when there's a pressure differential, it pulls out the radon. But the first thing is that the amount of radon it pulls out is not enough to produce the size of spike that we see here. And the other thing is that this occurs all along the whole border of Poland. So like every single detector goes up in unison in terms of like distance. If you imagine the plume, I haven't done this yet, but I will do this. I can do some plume calculations and show how slowly the thing moves and where it will go to and all the rest of it. I've got a lot of things to do, you know, so I can't do everything. But then, the other thing is that the other suspicious thing is that the Poles themselves started screaming. There's the Marie Curie Institute in Lublin, I think it is, and they published on the net. They published a graph of an increase in gamma radiation in Poland at this detector that they have. But this was a much more interesting graph because it showed it split down the radiation energies into different isotopes. The main isotopes being natural ones, okay? So it looked at the natural isotopes. And and the reason you would do that is in order to see whether anything was from radon. And what it showed was that there was a peak in bismuth 214, which is a radon daughter. But if you look closely at it, what you see is that actually the peak was really quite small, and it could not possibly have been high enough, because what they do is they show the bismuth 214 energy, and they show the total gamma radiation on the same graph, but with a different scale. So and you have to look very closely, and you have to understand Polish, which I don't, but I got my girlfriend to translate it. And so what you're looking at is a percentage increase in terms of each isotope. So this was a cover-up. The reason that this was produced was that it was to reassure everybody that that the effect was a natural one, that the effect was just due to some radon spike. But if you look closely, you can see it cannot possibly be that, because the total increase was really very small in terms of the proportion of bismuth 214. So listen, I may be wrong, okay? I really may be wrong about this, and it could be that there was a sudden unexplainable increase in radon. But certainly what I can say is that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what we're seeing here is a really massive public health problem. Yeah. Because these particles are very, very radiogenotoxic, you know, and they cause cancer and they cause birth defects and all the rest of it. And although they're quite far away by the time you get to the west of Poland and everywhere else, I can tell you that they, even at that concentration, are a serious hazard. So the only way that we will know for sure that this is uranium is if somebody traps it all in a filter and then measures it to see if it's uranium, which they can do. They have to do alpha spectroscopy, and that can be done. But in terms of the gamma, what I'm saying is that, first of all, it is a gamma emitter because of the two daughters, thorium-234 and protactinium-234M. So the gamma argument goes out the window. And then the fact that the whole of Poland is covered in this stuff, or rather that the detectors all went up together throughout the whole strip at a given distance from Chmielnicki, suggests that the increase, well, it almost proves that, you know, you can do the statistics on it. It almost proves that whatever it is that's increasing the radiation levels, the gamma radiation levels, is whatever it is that floated over from Chmielnicki. Well, I mean, the wind was in the right direction.
Chris, the vision of this enormous great explosion with this nasty, potentially anyway, nasty smoke. How would something like this compare to Chernobyl? Because, I mean, it must have been an absolutely massive explosion. Obviously, if you hit an arms dump, I mean, that's maybe a month's worth of people shooting in a war going up in smoke in a few seconds.
Oh, you're talking about thousands of tons of uranium, mate. I mean, you know, so it's not a small deal, and that's why, of course, they're all covering up like mad. That's the point. Everybody's freaking out. That's why they shut down the Germans the German server operates the European detector circuit system. Okay, that's what they do. It's actually the stuff put together in Italy. But the actual circuit is put on the web in Germany somewhere. But then immediately they shut it down. Okay, so there's another piece of evidence. Now it's come back up, but it's come back up in a way that when you look at all the detectors, which you can do, they've changed the way in which they display it. So you can't see any peak. They've averaged it over a few days or whatever it is. So all you get is like a flat line.
That's the voice of Dr. Chris Busby there, Martin. I mean, looking at this. It's particularly embarrassing for both sides if this is true, and if this plume of radiation does descend on Poland. It's also not the greatest PR from the West to the Polish, saying, hey guys, we've sent some depleted uranium ammunition and we're very sorry, but it seems to have kind of backfired, and you know, you could be dealing with this for many years to come. Actually, what Chris is suggesting here is this could be every bit as damaging as the Chernobyl fire was, and the plume that came from that, but no one wants to talk about it.
Well, you can see why not. Obviously, the Western side don't want to talk about it because it's terribly embarrassing. I mean, British government has made, as you know, such a big deal about how generous they're being in supplying DU ammunition to the Ukrainian forces. And also the Russians won't necessarily want to be boasting about it, because although they'll be happy to have destroyed the DU ammunition, they don't want it being fired at their tanks, obviously. It's actually quite a destructive thing to do, isn't it, for the reasons that Chris has explained. And it just, you know, reminds us all of what a tragedy this whole ridiculous war has been, completely unnecessary, and forced by, you know, forces who are simply, you know, pathological. That's the only way to describe it.
I mean, you could see it as tragic, but what in the piece we heard from Chris earlier, and in many other commentators are looking at Ukraine and saying, well, this is really not of any benefit to Ukrainians. The idea maybe just to deny, to kill millions of Ukrainians or hundreds of thousands to make room for other people to kind of come in and take the country over from the West.
I don't think there's going to be, there will be people taking over from the West, but they won't be bringing in a big population. I mean, the Ukrainian population has crashed as a result of all of this. People have left, people have died. You know, there's a whole generation of young people who've been slaughtered, and they, of course, will not have any children.
The full version of that will be up on our show page, that interview. Very interesting interview. I mean, he was chatting to me about all sorts of other things, as you heard, obviously, the Bilderberg, as he was discussing, as well as all sorts of other aspects of what's going on in the world today. And some of the, for example, his take on the historical development of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. So that's Dr. Chris Busby, and I'll put a link up to the full interview with him on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, we're going to have a look. Now, I mean, just before we get into some more clips, I thought it would be important to, because we were having some big discussions earlier about AI. News this week is that humans could achieve immortality and live forever within 8 years. Human lives could be extended thanks to a combination of biology and technology. Futurist and computer scientist who Charlie mentioned earlier on, Ray Kurzweil from Google, has made some predictions about when artificial intelligence will reach the singularity, which is a hypothesis point hypothetical point in time where technology growth is out of control and irreversible. He believes AI will catch up with true human intelligence around about 2029. That's handy for the Agenda 2030, isn't it? With immortality being possible the following year in 2030.
Well, that's very speculative, isn't it, to say the least? It's quite possible we're going to be blown up in a nuclear holocaust as a result of the war in Ukraine, and none of that will come about. Or we could be hit by an asteroid.
I think your former suggestion is more likely than the asteroid.
Yes, I think probably another, is, another, yeah.
Another bit of technology, a bit more mundane than human beings who have been hacked to live forever, is UK's first driverless bus service. I mean, I suppose the other thing about that is, if we were being told about it, if it was a film that had been created by artificial intelligence, could we even believe what we were being told? Of course, I've got a T-shirt on right now saying, I want to believe, with a picture of a flying saucer. Of course, people want to believe these things. Someone tells them that your children will be able to live forever, people get quite excited and they may even believe what you're saying. So anyway, the UK's first, back to the mundane, first driverless bus service starts taking passengers between Edinburgh and Fife. Vehicles, in fact, have two members of staff, a safety driver who can take control of the vehicle if it goes out of control, and a captain, they call him, who can sell tickets and provide customer service. Now, this is amazing, isn't it? Because most of our buses have only got one driver and no one else helping. It sounds to me as if they're a bit nervous that these buses might just career off the road and that people may get panic attacks on there. So they've got an extra member of staff on board.
Well, it rather defeats the object of having a driverless car, the vehicle, doesn't it? If you've got to have somebody there to make sure that the thing drives and somebody else... I mean, I'm all in favour of having people collecting tickets on buses.
Well, this is,
that's how we used to run it back in the day,
well,
isn't it?
This is a way of getting the unions on board, obviously, isn't it? So we're going to increase the number of staff on these buses, but of course, after a few years, those people will be sacked and you'll be getting on a bus that just moves around all on its own with no human being in sight to ask any questions or to do anything if it crashes.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that the reason why they have things like guards on trains is that drunken passengers can fight with each other. There's all sorts of things that can happen. It's not just a vehicle going from A to B. Once you've got human beings in largish numbers on board, anything can happen. People can have heart attacks. All sorts of things can happen. That's why we have, a human interface to deal with any emergencies. You know, what if somebody's, dropped a concrete block on the line of a train, for example, or there's an obstacle or whatever? And, I mean, a lot of this technology has got big potential. But, I mean, coming back to what we were talking about AI earlier in relation to Bilderberg, the real problem with labour-saving technology is that ultimately, as Marx pointed out in the 19th century, you can't exploit machines. Machines just carry on. You then get a contradiction between that there isn't enough demand in the society for the goods that the machines can produce. The machines can produce any amount of goods, but who's going to pay for them? Yeah, because if nobody's got any work because the machine's taken their jobs, then the system starts to break down. The way they deal with it is by creating debt so that you can push the dreadful day into the future.
Yes. I mean,
but of course, then that leads to bubbles which burst.
Well, or debt traps that mean that people end up with all of them in debt, and then they can easily be controlled using some sort of financial currency. Anyway, look, we've got another story this week. The good old Hercules aircraft. This is the C-130J aircraft. Apparently, Bryce Norton may be closing. But the Daily Express reports that the SAS and the SBS are very annoyed that their C-130J planes are being sold off, says an RAF insider. So it's some kind of job lot, almost certainly going to some airfield in the Arizona desert, probably, presumably, Martin, to sit next to those Harriers that were sold off back in, I think it was around about 2012, by the Cameron government. A whole load of Hercules being decommissioned now. And just these little tiny, in comparison, much smaller aircraft will be remaining. So Bryce Norton to close and the the Hercules aircraft all being sold off.
Well, that's the first I've heard of that. Yeah, well, I mean, the NATO stockpiles of all sorts of things are being thrown into the Ukrainian cauldron, and they can't necessarily be replaced. I mean, it's extraordinary. We've got this massive military-industrial complex in the West, which spends far more than all of the rest of the world combined, and in actual fact, it doesn't lead to a situation where we can produce ammunition at the rate that is necessary for the Ukrainians to sustain a war. I mean, it's just a great big white elephant, isn't it, the whole thing?
Well, this is not going to Ukraine. Apparently, these are just going to be sold off, and rather like the Harriers, basically the Royal Air Force is being bought up and just parked and taken away from the British, stuck over in America. The idea, of course, that, you know, the whole idea of this, surely, is to make sure that the British are totally dependent on the United States for defence, Martin.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, the whole fuss about whether there was or was not going to be some kind of European army, well, I mean, that's been smashed now.
I mean, do you think it's possible that the Americans are a bit concerned that maybe the British might not use their armed forces in the way the Americans want them to?
Well, they want British, French and other armed forces as part of their alliance to be totally subservient to them. I mean, that's what you'd expect. That's what they want. They don't want an independent British armed forces that does things that the Americans don't want it to do. Of course they don't.
It may be that if a war kicks off in Europe, that the Europeans might be not totally doing what the Americans are telling them to do. You know, there may be some sort of kickback against the Yanks.
Well, that's why the British and the Americans were always opposed to the idea of any kind of European army. And you've got the French who have always fantasised about setting one up. But the reality is that the British and the Americans won't allow it. They've never wanted to allow it, and they've moved, you know, they've made damn sure it doesn't happen. And of course, we're basically vassals of the United States. The whole of Europe is being forced to fight the Russians in the Ukraine to keep the US as top dog in the world. That's what's going on. And it's going to be devastating for living standards across the whole of Europe, both West and Eastern Europe. And eventually people may well wake up and say, well, we don't really want to be run by the United States of America. And that may turn into some kind of rebellion, but we're not there yet.
No, we're not quite, are we? Anyway, well, there's a bit of a rebellion going on Talk TV this week. We had a chap called Leslie in Glasgow call in to the Mike Graham show. They are making a big fuss on Talk TV about their enormous great listenership of 1 million people, which I don't think is actually, well, it's 1 in 50 people at some point during the week listen to Talk TV or Talk Radio. So I don't think it's that much to trumpet about. They are growing in their listenership bit by bit, but they don't help things by making you log on when you're trying to listen to it online and things like that. So maybe they need to pick up a trick or two, these Murdochites at Talk Radio, Talk TV. So let's have a listen now to Ukraine on the Talk TV channel this week, where Leslie in Glasgow phones in. He says he talks about... he reckons around about 150,000 Ukrainians versus 80,000 Russian casualties, and also the Ukrainian population going down from 35 to 21 million. What do you make, before we hear from him, what do you make of those figures, Martin? The casualty figures, 150,000 casualties in Ukraine, 80,000 for Russia, which is roughly two Ukrainians dying for every one Russian. And also the population, suddenly something like 14 million people fleeing Ukraine.
Well, the population being reduced is very definitely the case. And don't forget that there was a big drop in population during the so-called reform period after the fall of the Soviet Union, because it was social circumstances were so dire that the population started to go down. And of course the age of death started to go down. You know, life expectancy went down very dramatically. It was fairly poor in the Soviet era, but it went down as a result of free market capitalism.
Well, yeah, we heard from Olya last week, the Russian woman who had various of her family on both sides in this war, saying, well, some of them stayed to fight, but many of them now have decided, well, we're just going to get away. We're getting well away from this, because we thought this was just a kind of small dispute between the Donbass region and the Ukrainians, and it's turned out not to be. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Leslie in Glasgow on Talk TV this week.
Leslie, however, is in Glasgow, wants to talk about Ukraine. Hello, Leslie.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I don't think we should be sending, or our government should be sending, any more weapons to Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
I think instead we should be negotiating peace. Yeah. And our government and most of our media is not reporting on the losses of Ukrainians.
Yeah.
For example, according to the President of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, over 150,000 Ukrainians have been killed. And
yeah.
that comment was made over 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And tens of thousands have died since. Which puts the fatalities to probably over 200,000.
Yeah.
In addition, 3 years ago, the population of Ukraine was around 35 million. Now
yeah.
it's 21 million because millions have fled to Russia and Western Europe.
Uh-huh.
So I think when I look at the politicians, they appear to me to care more about defeating Russia than helping Ukraine, and they're willing to fight Russia to the last
yes.
Ukrainian. And I think it's quite disgusting, actually.
Well, as we heard, though, from Peter Hitchens and also from Alan Mendoza, you know, the belief is that it's Zelensky who wants to defeat Russia. He doesn't want to have peace at the moment. He wants to defeat Russia. So you'd have to take a view that if that's what he wants, then are you going to support him or are you going to not support him?
Can I just come in there? Like, that's nonsense, because according to Fiona Hill, the US National Security Advisor for Russian and European Affairs, there was a preliminary peace deal to be signed between Russia and Ukraine, mediated by Turkey, in April 2022.
Mm-hmm.
However, it was and Zelensky was willing to sign it, and Russia would withdraw from all territory in Ukraine, and Ukraine would agree to remain out of NATO and return to the Minsk Accords. It was the UK and the US that pressured Zelensky not to negotiate and instead continue the war. And again, that was according to Fiona Hill, the US National Security
yeah.
Advisor. So Zelensky, I know it sounds a bit out there to most people, but he's a puppet for the United States.
But why, though?
He was, why? Because they want to defeat Russia. Even if you go back to the Project for a New American Century, like persons like Robert Kagan, who's a husband to Victoria Nuland, who played an integral role in the coup of Yanukovych in Ukraine in 2014, these persons have been talking about overthrowing Putin for many, many years.
Right.
And in spite of all the sanctions on Russia and the weapons to Ukraine, the Russian economy is expected to grow more than the United Kingdom this year.
Well, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true at all. I wouldn't believe everything you read, Leslie. You know, the Russian economy is in the toilet. You saw the Russian military parade, didn't you? Had one tank in it.
That tank was an old Soviet tank.
Yes.
A commemoration of the Second World War.
So you think all things that come out of Russia are true and all things that come out of Ukraine are not true?
No, last year, according to the World Bank, not Russia.
I'm not interested in anything the World Bank's got to say either.
The World Bank said Russia's economy grew by 2.4% last year. That's more than the United Kingdom's. Moreover, the Russian military has grown by more than 300,000 men to 1.5 million.
Yeah, how many Russians have died in the war?
According to the Pentagon paper leaks, have you heard about that?
Yes.
Yeah, the Pentagon paper leaks put the Russian losses to less than 80,000.
But do you believe that?
That's according to the Pentagon.
Yeah, but you just said that Zelensky is Ukraine's puppet. He's America's puppet.
Yeah, because America...
So why would America put out anything that was true, then, if they were involved in a propaganda war with Russia?
Well, apparently it was a leak. The Pentagon didn't release this. This was a leak.
Okay. All right, Leslie. Thanks for your call.
Yes, Mike Graham trying to play cat and mouse with Leslie from Glasgow, and Leslie from Glasgow ending up very politely running rings around Mike Graham. But, I mean, his point really, Martin, is Graham's point is, oh, you wouldn't believe anything from America, but, oh, actually, it was a leak. He's doing everything he can to try and make out that what's going on in Ukraine is some sort of success for the West. Obviously, it's not, and actually the Russian economy is doing particularly well this week. We've seen an announcement of several of the BRICS countries are now pulling away from using the dollar, aren't they?
Well, that's an ongoing process, that's right. I think the idea that, you know, that chap, the host saying, but we all know the Russian economy is in the toilet, that's just rubbish, but it's what everybody, you know, in his circles pretends to believe. And of course, their best defence in the end is you don't believe everything the Russians say, do you? But as the chap from Glasgow pointed out, this is a leak from inside the Pentagon. Now, what may be happening there is people in the Pentagon, using this boy that's been blamed for all of this, are using this these leaks in order to try and bring some sense into the discussion. Because the politicians in the West have convinced themselves, because the media have told them, that the Ukrainians are winning. There's a back, they keep going on about this counter-offensive, which is just about to start, which is going to recapture the Crimea. And I just cannot see it, Tony. I cannot see it. The modern defense, you know, you're not going to see the big thrust that you saw in World War II because the technology's moved on. We've gone back to a sort of a technologically sophisticated World War I because you can't actually, neither side can actually get together large troop formations, A, without being spotted, and B, without them being attacked. So the only reason why you had that 40-mile long queue of tanks on the way to Kiev was because the Ukrainians had no air defence, so and they just couldn't do anything about it. But
I mean, you're saying that I'm trying to talk really a bit here about the economics of all this. Up to 30 countries ready to accept the BRICS new currency. More countries are registering interest to join the BRICS, an economic alliance of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and accept a new world currency. South Africa's top diplomat to BRICS, Ambassador Anil Sukhlal, has hinted the growing group is set to grow bigger this year, with more than 30 countries in the queue applying to join. Latest report indicates that countries ready to join are Afghanistan, Algeria, Argentina, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Belarus, Egypt, Indonesia, Iran, Kazakhstan, Mexico, Nicaragua, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, Sudan, Syria, UAE, Thailand, Tunisia, Turkey, Uruguay, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. So it does look as if the dollar's days are finished pretty much, doesn't it?
Well, it's going to be difficult to get rid of the dollar completely. The US, you know, what Peter Gowan used to call the Wall Street dollar regime, WSDR, is still quite powerful because a lot of the debts of developing countries are denominated in dollars. So as the Federal Reserve increases interest rates in the United States, their debts become unpayable. Now, this is a big dilemma, especially for the smaller countries, because they could just default and say, well, we're not going to pay these debts because we don't really owe this money anyway. In actual fact, they don't. It's all a scam. But if you do that, you're then going to be targeted in all kinds of ways, economic and other ways. But I think there's beginning to be a momentum behind an alternative financial system for the world. But I don't think we should get too carried away. There's a very interesting article by William Engdahl on Global Research, which I read yesterday, which points out the vulnerabilities of the Chinese economy. Because they've got a massive debt bubble there, because they expanded their economy after 2008 as a way of trying to help the West out, because the West was in trouble. The Chinese decided to spend money to expand their economy, which kept the whole of the world economy stabilized.
That sounds like the kind of skull and bones modus operandi that everyone's kind of decides that they're going to ditch the dollar, puts their chips over on the table of China, and then China goes down too. But Martin, we're going to finish with a little treat for you, which is someone you mentioned a couple of months ago on the show, and I've had this clip sitting around for a while. The lady's name is Cynthia Chung. Do you want to say something about her and why you suggested we should take notice of what she's got to say?
Well, I thought you would be interested in her because she's very strong on sort of cultural critique of Western, you know, the way the West works. I read her with interest, but I don't necessarily buy into everything that she says.
No. Well, I think I hope nobody buys into everything I say, and I hope nobody buys into everything you say. In fact, I was having a chat with this American guy, Josh, here, who seemed to be very upset that he didn't want to discuss something that he might disagree with. And I'm like, well, look, I'm not going to bite your head off. Let's have a chat about it. And that's the way things should be. That's professional journalism, and that's actually the way to run the world. The idea that someone doesn't agree with you is not a problem. It's just a possibility to learn more from whoever it is. Anyway, we're going to finish tonight with this clip, Martin, with Cynthia Chung. On the links, I mean, I put this in a sort of little section about eugenics, because obviously Bilderberg is some place where this is seen to be okay, you know, and it's in fact many people suggesting that Bilderberg is a place where many of these eugenics agendas are run out, like, for example, the links between the Bilderbergers and the whole COVID episode to do with the PR, the development of the vaccine, so-called vaccines, and the whole thing. I mean, the WikiSpooks did a brilliant article about the 100 or so people from Bilderberg who were involved in running COVID out across the world. So anyway, let's have a listen now, a little bit about eugenics from Cynthia Chung, where she talks about the eugenicist roots of the Great Reset.
In terms of this whole Tavistock thing, when all this goes to California, I think the big thing for people to get, because it's very complex, the story, is that he becomes friends with Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti is the what was sold by the Theosophist Society as Maitreya, the future Buddha. And this was by Annie Besant, who was not just a leading Theosophist member, but she was also a leading Fabian Society member. And also she was part of the Marxist Social Democratic grouping as well. And by the way, the Fabian Society is what started the Labour Party, which has connections into Trotskyism later on, because they wanted to infiltrate the Labour Party and organize the unions, but it was ultimately not about industry, but about politics. And, there was a lot of subversion from that angle as well. It's very complex. Luckily, it seems that the generation managing things right now, the Klaus Schwab generation, are not anywhere near as sophisticated. So just for people to keep that in mind, because I can see, it might be a little bit scary to go through some of this history that they're just like all knowing and they're everywhere. But luckily, they've been dumbing themselves down significantly. So good news there. So Krishnamurti actually is really good friends with Aldous Huxley. And this was part of the thing, that the undermining of Christianity, to do that, they were introducing a false spirituality. And, that Aldous Huxley, too, is very interested in studying the mysticism of religion. That is to the what, because, some people have like these outer body experiences. They're kind of like on the mystical side of religion. And there's this like, catharsis and things like this. And H.G. Wells brings this up too in his Open Conspiracy for the Modern Religion, that the modern religion should be really about just surrendering yourself to something with no thought, no belief structure, nothing. It's really of an emotional state. And that's what they were kind of corrupting from largely Hinduism teachings, was this kind of false spirituality. They had false gurus like Krishnamurti, which, Maitreya is supposed to be, the world's teacher that is not of any school or thought. But this guy was like completely tutored by Annie Besant for his, like, he was adopted like in as a teenager, and he was totally educated by Annie Besant. And like, people are supposed to believe that he's just, not representing any kind of angle or a viewpoint. What's interesting is that the Danta Society was a part of the Hindu religions. Like, I think there's seven schools, and Vedanta is one of them. There was a weirdness where Aldous, Gerald, and Christopher Isherwood were always at this Vedanta Society in Southern California, but there was the Swami there did not actually trust Krishnamurti, and they were also close with Krishnamurti. And there's a dialogue actually with Alan Watson, his autobiography, who is also, he's recognized as a guru of Zen Buddhism in the West, but he actually has direct ties to the Annie Besant school with the Buddhist lodge in England, under Christmas Humphrey, who, like, Annie Besant, Alice Bailey, close direct connections to. Alan Watts has this conversation with this Swami from the Vedanta Society in Southern California, basically, with his bullshit interpretation of the philosophy that you don't need to do any work in order to be enlightened. And the Swami's like, no, no, that's not how it works. You do have to have discipline. You do have to work on yourself and all of this. And so it's very clear there, like Alan Watts actually shares this in his autobiography as if, like, you know, this is him bragging. So Krishnamurti, you know, there's a lot of controversy because, you know, he said that he wasn't any longer a part of the Theosophist Society, but actually this is totally not true. He always promoted the Theosophist Society for his entire life. And the clearest thing to prove that is that he sets up a school called something like the Happy Valley School with Aldous Huxley as one of the people, which is later on called the Annie Besant School. So I don't think you could have it any more clear than that. And so Krishnamurti is one of the major influencers of the counterculture movement in terms of this false idea of spirituality. And the counterculture movement is basically, you know, William Sargent, who is also kind of, in, he's like not directly on record involved with the Tavistock Institute, but he pretty much is. And he was at the pioneering stage of this whole like Manchurian candidate studies and, you know, how to create a blank slate and put another personality into that person and so forth. You know, Ewan Cameron's treatments at McGill and all of this are pretty much as a result of William Sargent's work. And William Sargent was good friends with Aldous Huxley, and they even mention each other many times in their lectures and their books. They're very much intrigued by each other's thoughts on things. And again, it was this idea of like, how do you increase suggestibility? Because it was found that it's suggestibility works best if it's done by an illusion of free will. So you can't force it's it, you can cause stress and things like this, but ultimately the best forms of suggestibility, which will be the most stable, are when someone thinks that they're taking it in from free choice. And so this kind of mass conditioning that we're seeing that is effective in many ways, but has its limitations, is very much along this process of what they've been studying. And the counterculture movement was not just this, like, you know, let's replace all of these like teachings and proper education with just like, I can be enlightened just by like something that comes into my head. Like, I can say that it came into my head from this other thing. You know, like Alice Bailey said that her Rays of Initiation, or I think one of those books, was from this Tibetan that was talking to her through telepathy. So you can have all these kinds of like, you know, bullshit reasons for why what you're saying is for, you know, enlightened, instead of actually using reason to determine these things.
Enlightened by voices in your head, Martin, rather than actually making your reasoned arguments and having it all peer-reviewed or whatever.
Well, I mean, the history of these kind of countercultural ideas goes back, you know, quite a way. You know, the First World War had a big impact in terms of changing people's ideas about rationality, the Enlightenment, and so on. Because it seemed that, you know, Western society, despite all of its, you know, pretended rationality, seemed to have a huge irrationality at the heart of it. And at that point, you know, lots of intellectuals in the West started to take very seriously what they thought of as Eastern religious ways of thinking about things and so on. And that's what wars do. They shake up people's ideas. They make them think of new thoughts, as it were. But of course, they're not necessarily any better than the old thoughts.
You know,
they're just different.
In a way, an absolutely amazing way to end the show this week is looking at all this, because Huxley and William Sargent, who's the author of The Battle for the Mind, these people, I mean, what we're hearing from Cynthia there is they were basically saying, oh, we think this is really not such a good thing, but that they were attempting, obviously, Huxley with his dystopian novel. They were kind of suggesting that this is the way things are going. They were suggesting the ways that we might want to think about it. They were offering us up solutions and apparently offering us a choice as to what we thought about this, very similar to the way that the Bilderbergers are dealing with this whole business of artificial intelligence, for example. They're really kind of dictating the bounds of what people might think about what we need to do about this, and presenting it as a problem that, you know, they've been doing a bit of thinking for us and saying, well, actually, maybe we should do this about it. And of course, that means that the people who are involved in creating these problems are also involved in setting the agenda as a so-called solution.
Well, I think you're over determining it. It's well known that the people who developed sort of computer technology in Silicon Valley in California, many of them had taken LSD, which had been synthesized in the 1940s and was used by the CIA in mind control programs, MKUltra and so on and so forth. And of course, people who were given it then decided that it was a way to enlightenment, as it were. Aldous Huxley famously took it on his deathbed. He requested it and he was given it. I think
Martin, let me just pin you down, because do you think Sargent and Huxley really were genuinely really concerned about this and wanted to make sure that humanity didn't take those sorts of directions, and that, because they seem to be talking much more about the problem than about the solutions, just as these people like Ray Kurzweil now and Yuval Noah Harari are?
Well, look, there's all sorts of different ways to approach these kind of things. You know, some people become, I mean, lots of people, for example, used to use psychedelic drugs, and then they decided that they wanted to become Buddhists. It's a very well-established thing in the West. It's to do with the evolution of Western intellectual culture. In Western intellectual culture used to be, you know, boringly rationalistic, but then the Romantics came along, and Wordsworth and Blake. And you know, this has been an ongoing dialogue within Western culture, and of course in relation to other cultures, and of course lots of mainstream Buddhists and Hindus, for example, in India and elsewhere, regard all of this sort of Western mysticism as a load of drivel.
Well,
but then that they're entitled to do that. But on the other hand, people are going to believe what they want to believe, aren't they?
It sounds as if we should have some sort of debate between you and Cynthia Chung, because you're putting completely opposite view.
I'm not putting opposite views. I don't disagree with her that there's all of these interesting linkages between these different groups of people. Of course there are. I mean, the world is full of networks of people who are interested in certain things. But I think she's reading too much into the intellectual rebellion against rationality in Western culture. It's been there for hundreds of years. You know, St. Francis of Assisi rebelled against the society of his time and came up with a different way of thinking about God and the church and so on. And the Albigensian, the Albigensians were, you know, who were basically some kind of Zoroastrians, were persecuted to death by the Catholic Church. And then the Protestants came along and said, we don't believe in the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
this is just human culture developing.
One way of looking at things, I mean, you could also see it as a kind of battle between good and evil, as they're basically people who are trying to control other people, and others, they're, you know, sort of putting up counter-arguments. And we don't hear a lot, for example, from Yuval Noah Harari about, you know, how we need more small holdings, which, you know, would take away a lot of the problems with the carrying capacity of the earth, etc., and that sort of thing. Anyway, look, we're going to have to wind up now, Martin. Thank you ever so much for your time. Time to sign off. Our guest, Martin Summers, you've just heard there, Irish Republican Labour activist, also to the writer, comedy writer and freelance journalist Charlie Skelton, as well as Portuguese freelancer Frederico Carvalho, who we've heard there. And also, of course, much thanks to Dr. Chris Busby and, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or any way you like. Do please send us interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page at thisweek.org.uk, where you'll also find the this podcast in a couple of hours' time, full-length interviews, story links, and the comment page, and our email addresses if you want to get in touch with us during the week. You can also subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I must do a little plug for my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, because we talked quite a lot about that tonight, which Dave Barmby, who died last week, helped me a lot with. And you can find links to that at bilderberg.org. You can buy a copy of it on eBay, and I think there are one or two other places. It's always a good idea to go to bookfinder.com and see whereabouts you can get hold of these things. And also, we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stoke-Stroft, and also live from Lisbon in Portugal, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, please let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream back in Bristol at talkradio.org.uk and on the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Thank you. Thank you.